Craig, what are you doing out in the snow?
Because UFC 287's coming up this weekend from Miami. I gotta soak up these rays. I gotta get used to the environment. I gotta get excited about these fights. I mean, what do we always say?
What do you always say?
Wipe that off. Let's get into it.
Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your hosts, Craig
and Matt
Allen.
And just like that, we're back with Fight Night Picks getting set for UFC 287. As always, one half of your host, duo, Craig Allen, Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP. You probably saw me hanging out in the snow at the start of the episode. I love to do that, especially wearing my pool attire with me, as always.
You must have filmed that during the only 15 minutes of sun that day, too, because yesterday was terrible for the rest of it.
It was terrible. That was Saturday, but Matt Allen, as always, at Matt Allen FNP. And listen, we're getting set for another big-time card. This is one of those ones, the fourth meeting between the two guys in the headline. Back in November, you had Pereira getting the belt over Adesanya, picking it up in the fifth round. But why do I say it's the fourth time? Because they're going to bill this as Adesanya Pereira 2 or vice versa. These two met in 2016, 2017. It was Pereira getting the wins over in kickboxing. A chintzy decision call the first time out. There were no questions after the second meeting with Pereira picking up a big-time knockout win down in Brazil. But overall, you look at this card, I was a little let down. I thought, hey, I got a nugget of information for the Fight Night Picks fans out there. This is the first time since, what is it, 2003, back at UFC 42 Sudden Impact, when Matt Hughes took on the Muscle Shark Sean Sherk in the main event, and Pete Spratt beat Robbie Lawler on that card, that the UFC's going back to Miami. I couldn't believe it at the time. It's now the Miami-Dade Arena, because FTX just blew it for everybody, they had to rename it. But Matt, overall, I know we're really excited about this one. Co-main event, a couple of Florida staples. Gilbert Burns taking on Jorge Masvidal, and Masvidal getting a lot of shine in this one. He was recently on the Joe Rogan MMA show, so a lot to really dissect in this one. 13 total fights. Michael Chiesa kind of left out in the ether. He might get added into it, but I know you're really amped, especially for this main card.
It's a phenomenal card top to bottom, but I think you'd agree with me. A lot of the big names on this card, not only are big names, they desperately need a win. Like, think about who the A side of the main event is. I know Alex Pereira currently has the UFC title, but I think it's pretty easy to say Israel Adesanya is the more valuable commodity. He really needs a win in this main event, because it's going to be difficult to sell what would ultimately be a fifth fight between him and Pereira. If he does ultimately lose the first four, same thing, Jorge Masvidal, a big star, but he really needs a win to kind of maintain his spot in the top of the welterweight division. You go down the card, guys like Rob Font, Kevin Holland, and Ponce Dibio, they're kind of those in-betweeners. They're trying to stake their claim that they're still contenders in the welterweight division, but a loss for either one of those is a big deal. So I think there's a lot of big names on this card, but I think a lot of those fighters really need a win.
A lot of big name fights that are on this one. Like I said, 13 total right now. We'll throw it on over to the Fight Night Picks Fight of the Night screen. Make sure you comment down below and let us know who you have in the Fight of the Night screen.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
Call me Adrian, call me Yanez. It's Adrian Yanez taking on Rob Font. First fight in the Fight of the Night screen. This one at 135, and if you do consider it, two of the last three main events in the UFC have been at bantamweight. You saw Merab Dolashvili getting a giant win, Corey Sandhagen getting a giant win. These two men both need a win, and I know for Rob Font more so than for Yanez, because for Yanez, he hasn't lost a fight since 2018, and Rob Font's on that two-fight skid. All three of his last fights are main events, so he gets to dip his toes back into that three-rounder pool. And I've got a lot to say on this overall card about five-round fighters fighting in three-round fights. But when we look at this one, Matt, two guys that primarily box in their fights. Adrian likes to throw a little bit more of the kick. So for Yo Adrian, a big-time opportunity to kind of jump the queue at bantamweight for Rob Font, the get-back fight here.
But this seems like a perfect fight, like a match made in heaven for a prospect fighting one of those guys who still deserves to be in the top 15. I don't think anybody anybody argues that about a guy like Rob Font, but we have seen him main event some big shows like you mentioned, and he hasn't always come out on top, so I think this is a perfect stylistic matchup to have that crafty vet fight the up-and-coming prospect, because like you said, these are two primary boxers, and we've kind of seen this before, like when Rob Font fights a primary striker, have the fights ever been boring? No, they're not. Normally they're pretty incredible, so I think that should be a really fun fight.
Well, I mean, a lot of big time ones to look for, and you hate to cherry pick co-main event and main event, so we zig where the zag is and go to 170 pounds. Kevin Holland, his last time out, fight of the night against Stephen Wonderboy Thompson, broke his right hand early on in that one, and in the third and the fourth rounds, that's where Holland was kind of left out in no man's land at the end of the fourth round. I mean, Stephen Thompson was absolutely going to town. Crew Bob Perez throwing in the towel between the fourth and the fifth. Holland now going from that December main event slot, now taking on Santiago Ponzinibbio. And for Ponzinibbio, his last time out, Morono won the first, Morono won the second, and in the third round, Morono was on his way on 4 days' notice to beating Santiago Ponzinibbio. Ponzinibbio pulled it out and absolutely freeze-framed old Morono to the face. So a big-time opportunity. Guys that are no stranger to actual fight of the nights, not just a fight night picks
and
fight of the nights.
For as well known as both of these guys are, this is a bit of an interesting matchup because I know I mention it all the time. Kevin Holland beat Jeff Neal at 170 before they came to the UFC, and I think that does matter. But for Kevin Holland, he still is trying to prove where he belongs in 170 pounds. We know how talented he was at 185 pounds. We understand the limitations physically he had at middleweight, but we are still kind of left waiting to see that kind of pristine version of Kevin Holland at 170 pounds. And for Ponzinibbio, it's kind of the opposite. We know exactly what we're going to get out of Ponzinibbio. It never really is a question. I know as he's aged, the output has diminished a little bit, but he still has the great power. He still has phenomenal technique. And if you go in there taking a guy like Ponzinibbio lightly, that's when he is going to shock you with those big combinations, some of that big power. So again, I think this is another perfect fight for the welterweight division.
A lot of great fights in this card. I know people are really going to be eager to see that middleweight bout on the prelims between B. Joe Pyfer taking on Gerald Meerschaert. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in the fight of the night screen. So when you have a look at this card, there's only one rookie debut, and it's the LFA strawweight champion, Jacqueline Amorim. She's going to be taking on Sam Hughes in the curtain jerker to start the prelims, and that's definitely an exciting fight. Amorim is one of the most accredited jiu-jitsu players that we've seen enter into the UFC in a bit of time, but if you do go down through it, obviously, to kick off the main card, the 18-year-old phenom, Raul Rosas Jr., he's going to be taking on fellow Uber prospect, and I don't say that lightly, in Rufus Sports Christian Rodriguez, a guy that the team has been talking about for a very long time, picked up a performance bonus his last time out, his octagon win. I've never seen somebody pick up their first win in the UFC and look like they expected it to happen and have no... It was like Sidney Crosby when he scores a goal. I've scored so many more, I don't have to get excited about it. But when you go up and down through this card, we talk about it. A lot of fighters that really need wins. Chase Sherman, Cynthia Calvillo.
Kelvin Gastelum at the top of that list.
Kelvin Gastelum, and Gastelum is on a slide, but he's going to be taking on Chris Curtis. That's the one that get you eager to spend your hard-earned money to buy that main card. I know, again, we're very excited about this card, but as I said to start this off, Michael Chiesa kind of left out in the ether. His fight against Li Jingliang is off. Is Kevin Lee going to step in? Are we going to get that one again? I don't know, but it is overall a very interesting card. A lot of fighters that need a win, and those are usually the fights where, hey, they produce.
It's a great card overall. Again, we have a lot of prospects fighting the more established veterans in the division, and those are always really fun fights because it just helps you establish where everybody does belong in said division. Again, Joe Pyfer, Gerald Meerschaert. Like, Joe Pyfer's been pushed heavily by the UFC off a contender series. How many times have we seen hype trains get derailed by Gerald Meerschaert? A number of times now. So I don't think that's just a clear-cut matchup where it's like, oh, our prospect's going to be softball toss and easy win. But Gerald Meerschaert's going to be a really tough fight. Same thing, Lupita Godina, Cynthia Calvillo. There's a lot of these established vets who are fighting these rookies, and those are fights I'm always excited for.
A big-time opportunity for all of these fighters down in Miami. Make sure you check it out on Saturday. Kicks 2 hours before the prelims. You can check out all of the content here at Fight Night Picks on YouTube. So much going on this week with UFC 286. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. And a welcome to the UFC to BJJ Ace and LFA strawweight champ. It is Jacqueline Amorim making her UFC debut coming up this weekend against Fortis MMA's Sam Page, Sam Hughes, and Matt. there's a lot of different layers to there this is. Fight. You really want to talk about the nickname?
Do you know what this fight makes me think of, though? This fight, to me, is like that game Grounders when you're in elementary school. You know, you want to jump up on all the different equipment because someone's going to go, Grounders, then you hear, because there's some liar in the group who's like, I wasn't on the ground, because they jump on the slide, but we all know they were on the ground. My whole point is, though, this fight to me is like a game of Grounders intensified in an MMA cage, because you had kind of alluded to it in the intro. Our new UFC debutante over here is very dangerous off of her back and very dangerous with jiu-jitsu. And Sam Page is someone who every single time we talk about her fights, people are probably going to roll their eyes. She has the track and field background. She has great cardio. So for her, I think it will be really interesting to see how long can she not make mistakes? How long can she stay on the slide without getting into the rocks and saying grounders?
And when people are going to say, okay, differing backgrounds, that's where I was going with it. For Sam Hughes, down at Wofford, she was a track and field star. And she mixed
Tell
it up.
Us more.
She switched around through colleges. She somehow found her way in the Pacific Northwest. A friend invited her to train MMA, and then all of a sudden she's kicking things off. She's winning fights. She had an amateur fight for a title that she lost against Lupita Godinez, who's also on this card. But as she went up through, I mean, she's fighting for that LFA strawweight belt against Vanessa Demopoulos. She beat her inside of three rounds. But then the fourth round came a knocking, and Vanessa decided, I'm really good at inverted triangles, I'm going to win this fight, and she did. But for Sam Hughes, it makes it into the UFC. There's been more downs than there has been ups. Her last three fights, she is 2-1. Her last time out, she was the loser in that matchup, taking on Piera Rodriguez, and it just so happened that Rodriguez, off the back foot, was able to land a lot of her boxing combinations. But when you couple the fact that Sam Hughes was great at track and field in college, Jacqueline Amarim, and I'm going to throw it up there for her accolades in jiu-jitsu. She's a BJJ black belt under Faustino Neto, and I got some of this information from BJJ Heroes. You might have heard of BJJ Heroes, the most notable
big website.
The websites, but you go down through it, that's the same coach that helped develop Carlos Diego Fajeda and one of Matt's favorite Brazilian Canadians, Bibiano Fernandez.
Wow.
He's able to do lots of great work down there. But if you and look at it, she then moved with her then husband up to South Carolina, started training out of Team Checkmate. You can see it in the picture right there. That is the gym that she represents. And then you consider it, Matt. Third place 2017 IBJJF Worlds. In 2016, she was the second place in No-Gi Worlds.
I mean,
among other. Jacqueline Amarim was very, very, very accredited in not just regular Gi Jiu-Jitsu, but No-Gi as well. Switched gears and then became a professional mixed martial artist. She's finished all six of her wins, all of them inside of the first round, five of them by submission. In four different types of submission
wins, too.
And
that's the impressive thing to see. Like, I know I really like Damian Maia. I talk about his jiu-jitsu a lot. But Maya's a guy who you really think of with the rear naked choke, right? That was what he was always trying to build to on the ground. But for Amarim, it is really nice to see her fish for different types of submissions. And again, that's going to be very important in this matchup. And it's a weird fight because Amarim is definitely more likely to get a finish at any point. Because for Sam Hughes, she'll weaponize her cardio. But does she really have tremendous punching power? Does she have volume like Max Holloway that's going to get a TKO? No, not necessarily. And I'm not saying she's a bad grappler by any means, but a lot of her grappling does come down to her pace, her tenacity. It's not necessarily the fact that she has, like, tier one jiu-jitsu types of skills. And that's why I do think this fight really is going to be important to see what kind of a pace Sam Hughes brings into it. Because she really is going to have to bank rounds. Because I think at any moment on the mat, what I like out of Amarim and what I watched out of her is she doesn't waste a lot of time just holding down that full guard, waiting for things to happen. She's squirmy off the back. And I think that will give Sam Hughes some troubles. Because Hughes is someone who, and I don't say this to say it as a negative because it has been effective up until a certain point. She is in the UFC, but she will get into that full guard, just kind of hold down position. She'll prioritize position, a little bit of ground and pound over submission. And if she does get a little lackadaisical in some of those positions, leaves her arms in careless positions in that full guard, we could see Amarim start this, to pick up off of the mat.
There's a giant trouble with this one though, and it's kind of a trap card. Sam Hughes, I mean, she's kind of one of those cardio queens.
Okay.
I'd say king, but she's cardio queen out of it because she can go a hard three rounds. She can continue to knock away at the competition. You saw her fight against Elise Reed from that top position. She did look good. Her wrestling was really good in that fight. For Jacqueline, We haven't seen her out of the first round, and even in some of these fights, let's go down through them. Her fight against at LFA 101, you go back that far against Taisha Gandhi, she was a minus 2,000 favorite.
It's a big favorite.
She had no head movement, ate every single jab, and then in 10 seconds goes all the way across the cage with her arms out, gets the takedown, and earns the submission win by a rear naked choke. Her next time out at LFA 110, she's taking on the first of two Canadians in her career, 34-year-old, tricky fighter, name of Megan Owen. And in that fight, she throws one left hook and knocks her out, and it's done really, really quick. So that's just a lot of fun.
Would you agree with me, though? I do think her foundational skills, although they don't make up for an amateur background or anything like that, they are an amount of experience that I think will help her in the UFC.
She doesn't throw any volume when she strikes. She doesn't move her head.
But that's fine. We've seen people like Melissa Gatto make it to the UFC and have success based on a deadly jiu-jitsu game facing primary wrestlers and take her down.
She was able to switch it up.
But I get that. She was able to switch it up later on in her career after long layoffs and stuff. I just mean, there are fighters out there who can win the first handful of fights just based on that foundational skill set. I'm not saying she's going to make it to the top 15 from this, but I do think that BJJ is lethal enough to get wins.
Amarim getting the belt the first time she tried for it. It was supposed to be at LFA 118. The quote is, unable to meet the sanctioning requirements from the California State Athletic Commission has been canceled. So they had to move her versus Loveth Young to LFA 125. In that fight, Amarim's able to get the takedown really easily. But when she goes to pick Young up, what does Young do? Two hands in the cage. So referee John English, friend of the show, he takes a point. And ultimately, Amarim's able to go out there, get it done, get the submission win. And then defending the belt against Nichols, 36-year-old Canadian, just taking on old Canadians. They do nothing for the majority of the first round. And then as it goes on, you have Amarim that's able to really kind of scrap things out, getting that win out there once more. So when you do go down through it, I know Hughes is 2-4 in the UFC. She fights behind boxing combinations. Her offensive takedowns are quite good. Her cardio is her superpower. And she is one of those tricky fighters. If all fights are five rounds like Charles Johnson,
Brandon Moreno is probably the example I was
thinking. They would win every single fight. For Amarim, we haven't seen her out of the first round, so it really is tricky to say, well, if it goes to a second, Amarim, I know her striking is going to carry her to a win, because I just don't know that. And for Sam Hughes, she's a tough out, especially in the first round, though. But when you look at it, Amarim open to minus 400 favorite, minus 255 right now. Sam Hughes open plus 330, plus 200 as it stands. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say over under 92.5% Amarim.
I think they'll be under, but she'll be the favorite.
They are wild. 1,568 total votes, 87% Amarim, 64% by submission. For the 13% that have Sam Hughes, 62% by decision. Amarim's never been out of a first round. Does she beat Sam Hughes?
This is what I don't like about Sam Hughes. And just because I'm saying it doesn't mean I'm right, but she's been in the UFC for a while now, and her level of competition has always been about what it's at right now. Fighting people who are making their debuts, and if they beat her, that's good.
She fought Tisha Torres on short notice.
Okay, but that was her taking the fight on short notice, so that's a little bit different. All of her other fights, other than that, have been a lot of entry-level fighters, and she has looked good in some of those, but she hasn't looked great in some other ones. So I think for Hughes, she could go out there and win a 30-27 decision. I do think her cardio can carry her to that length, but I think it's going to be really dangerous on the mat. So for where the odds are, I am going to pick Sam Hughes. I do think her wrestling is enough of an X factor, because again, her pace is going to be difficult to match for a lot of fighters, and until I do see it with Amarim, it is going to be hard to be completely sold on her. So this is one of those fights where I'm willing to be wrong right now, but open to being right in the future about Amarim. I think she does have a decent ceiling if she is able to start mixing her martial arts a little bit better, showing us a little bit more of her skill set. But up until then, I'm going to pick Sam Hughes.
Sam Hughes trains with the best camp to get ready for somebody like Jacqueline Amarim. She's definitely set herself up well at Fortis MMA. You look at the level of training partner, Emily Ducati and Jinyu Fry are the main training partners for Sam Hughes. For Jacqueline Amarim, and I'll throw the picture up there right now, she trains an American Top Team with the Yankees' biggest fan is Tella Nunez, who's been in a corner before with the Yankees cap, and Juicy Formiga, whose hairline now looks better than it ever has.
Did he do the Brian Urlacher after he retired?
It's better than it ever has been. So for Jacqueline Amarim, a really good job there. For Sam Hughes, her takedown defense is porous, but she's been able to pop back up to her feet and get back over to the fence very quickly. But for me, when I do look at this fight, Jacqueline Amarim has that one hit, one kill jiu-jitsu. And Matt, split decisions have killed me to start this year. I'm going with the proven finisher in Jacqueline Amarim to get the win. We're split on this pick. Matt going with Sam Page. I'm going with Amarim. You let us know down below in the comments section who you have in the strawweight matchup to kick off the card. Big time card coming up with Adesanya and Pereira in the main event. The fourplex of fights. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Featherweights clash at UFC 287 in a battle that has family ties. We have the Mean Machine, Steve Garcia, taking on the Wolverine, Shailan Nordembeka. And Matt, for Shailan Nordembeka, his last time out, his iron stomach won him the fight. He took on Derek Minner. And if you're trying to find the fight over on Fight Pass, I had a hard time trying to find it. I typed in Shailan, I typed in Nordembeka. They have it as Shah space Yilan versus Derek Minner. And in that one, Minner went out there, threw the leg kick, and it looked good when he was fighting from the orthodox stance. Then he switches over to southpaw, throws a body kick, recoils in pain, throws another body kick, ends up against the cage. Nordembeka, big elbow into all of the elbows, down in his ground and pound. He picked up a giant win. Derek Minner's out of the UFC. James Krause is out of the UFC.
Did we learn that much from that performance?
And I do not think that we did. So now Nordembeka gets to come into this matchup on a 3-fight win streak. And I say that there's family ties to open up this video, because for Nordembeka, he said in an interview, and this is a weird part, or the part that weirded me out a little bit. So I guess I'll throw up the tweet there from JHK where he says that Mahashata is his cousin. And it was an interview on Combat Sports and Fanatics View with Lynch where he said it was his younger brother. But either way, there's family ties with Nordembeka and his main training partner, Mahashata, having fought Steve Garcia. And Mahashata dropped him with the same right cross twice in the first round. Now, the big difference is Nordembeka throws giant looping hooks all the time with full power from round one to round three. Mahashata is much taller, upright, and throws a lot of straight shots. So not a lot of similarities there, but definitely a good look for Nordembeka. Training at Killcliff with Li Jingliang, formerly of China Top Team, with Mahashata. And then the big part for Nordembeka in a matchup like this, he has really good wrestling. And the foundation of his skill set.
That's why this fight is so interesting. Because to me, Nordembeka could fight like Steve Garcia. He'd win way less fights, though. Like, yeah. If he wanted to just start throwing crazy, reckless combinations, not rely on the power. And I do agree with you. The output might not necessarily be where you want it to be when he's moving forward. But to his credit, when he does land those big shots, like, they're devastating when he is able to land them. And I think a guy like Steve Garcia, is he going to go out there and win a lot of moments? Yes, he is. But he's going to give you moments that you otherwise would not have been able to get because he leaves so many openings with his own striking style. And you bring it up with Nordembeka. He does have a pretty advanced offensive wrestling game. We have seen that quite a bit. Not even just in the UFC. If you watch a lot of his fights pre-UFC, the wrestling is a big part of his game. So it'll be interesting
to see. TLC wrote a song about the guys that Nordembeka was fighting in China.
No scrubs?
They didn't want no scrubs.
Exactly, and that's the nice thing about Nordembeka. I know his record is insane, 39-10, and it has changed. Exactly.
It was 19-7 when he fought Sean Soriano, and then his next time out against...
But why would you lie about that? 39-10 is way better than 19-7.
Yeah, I don't think it's his fight.
No, I'm just saying, like, if you're going to have a record, I would much rather have the 39-10.
They took some Mrs. Dash and threw some spice on
it. This is my whole point about Nordembeka. He has very powerful counter shots off the back foot. We've seen that a lot, and he's a very good wrestler, especially when guys are crashing forward into him. He's a good guy at deciphering, okay, when can I shoot for the takedown? When should I match the guy with strikes? Steve Garcia is going to give you the opportunity to do both of those things, and I think that's why the odds are where they are. I know we normally get to that later on in the show, but
I wish we would.
When I had initially looked at this fight, I was kind of surprised at the odds, but after I started doing a little bit more research about it, kind of thinking about both guys' fighting styles, I can't really disagree with them, because I do think Garcia is going to accentuate a few of the things Nordembeka does excel at. Like you had mentioned, wrestling is one of those things that Nordembeka might not get the credit for because a lot of guys do think of that big power, but I think that'll be utilized quite a bit in this matchup against Garcia.
Nordembeka fought 13 times in 2016. He fought 18 times in 2017. Like, was he sitting on a porch just ripping darts waiting for the next fight?
Pretty much, just like, wherever you are, I'll be there.
So I had it written down in my notes. I had chest, low hands when striking, power over volume, and two straight Krause corners in his last two fights. TJ Brown and Derek Minner doesn't get that opportunity in this one. Mean Machine is a guy that when he was a teenager, fought out of a satellite camp or started to train out of a satellite camp of Jackson's. He's been a longtime Jackson Wink guy. And if you break down his record, Garcia was 5-2 in Bellator, 2-2 in the UFC, and he main evented LFA 80, and that was what got him into the UFC. Because for Garcia, you go down through it, has he fought wrestlers and beaten them? Yeah. Has he fought better wrestlers than Shai Ilan and beaten them? Yeah, he's beaten Ronnie Lawrence and Sean Bunch. And if you know Daniel Cormier, he likes Sean Bunch, and so do I. So those are two really powerful, impactful wins for me that Garcia has coming into a matchup like this. And then if you do the deep dive on the tape of Garcia, I wasn't necessarily sold on him when he came in and fought Luis Pena. And in that fight, yes, did Pena get a lot of takedowns? No, it was officially credited as 0 of 1 on takedown attempts. But where the positions found themselves, Pena had a ton of control time on the back of Steve Garcia. Charlie Ontiveros dropped Garcia twice, and then in the second round, Garcia rallied back.
Garcia got that dog in him. You know, you can't say he doesn't.
Mahashatta dropped him twice with the same shot. And then when Garcia took on Chase Hooper, I spent the whole video saying Steve Garcia is probably going to win this fight.
Did we both have him? Yeah.
Only at the end to go, nah, but I like Chase Hooper, the grappling. I always worry about it when Garcia's taking on these types of guys. And Garcia in that matchup, first knockdown was a left hook. He was credited with two knockdowns. I counted three.
He looked like the greatest fighter of all time.
Second one was a straight left, and those were both inside a minute. And then the third one, it was left hook and then like a slapping left that just kind of dropped Chase Hooper. So for Garcia, it's the stance switches, the crouching. Now, he's not like Rob Font, because Rob Font tucks his chin.
I like the praying mantis thing you're doing.
Rob Font tucks his chin and then tosses his jab out there and then mixes in his 1-2 and an uppercut. Steve Garcia just kind of tucks his chin in and throws a lot of
and
power.
And eats a lot of those shots, though.
But when you look at a matchup like this, both these guys are hittable. Shai Ilan holds his hands low and throws looping shots. Garcia throws the quicker, straighter shots. So for those
reasons, it's a fun fight, though. I think we both agree on that. Like, for being the second fight on this card, this is going to be a really fun one, I think.
It is. It's a really tough one to try and offer you up a pick on as well, because for me, I look at it as Nordenbeck has the X factor, the wrestling, but Garcia's beaten wrestlers and has decent takedown defense. And the biggest component of this fight, has Shai Ilan fought at lightweight? Yes. Has Steve Garcia fought at lightweight? Yes. Has Steve Garcia fought at bantamweight? Somehow. But when I look at this fight, I assume in my mind's eye, the guy that has the big height and reach advantage is also physically gifted and larger. So when you look at the matchup, Matt, Shai Ilan is favored to get the win. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprise to us there to you. I'm going to say over under 75% for the Wolverine.
I think they'll be over.
I think they're going to be over there. Over 1,626 total votes, 87%. Nordenbeka, 52% by decision, 38% by knockout. For the 13% that have the mean machine, 47% by decision, 41% by knockout. Who've you got?
For Steve Garcia, I think that chaos can give him a little bit of success.
All day.
It reminds me of something Michael Chandler said about Justin Gaethje way back when he first entered the UFC, and he said, Gaethje doesn't have to fight like that. Like, he only does it because he doesn't have the other parts of his game to fall back on, so that's why he's the crazy man. Now, to Gaethje's credit, I think we saw in the fight against Fazeev, he has started to evolve some of those skills, but Gaethje is a guy who he brawls because there's kind of a lack of that plan B. And I know Gaethje's not the best example because as his UFC career has continued, he has been able to start to flesh out some of those skills, but for Garcia, I kind of said to open this up, Nordenbeka could fight like Steve Garcia if he wanted to. He kind of does with the striking. The thing is, he's a little bit more put together with his striking. He's not going to leave the openings because the volume's not there with the hooks. And I think he will be able to shoot in for the takedown because Garcia's a guy who is not afraid to move forward in this fight.
So I like the fight that Nordenbeka had against TJ Brown, oddly enough, because in that matchup, if you do consider it, was it a really close fight? Sure it was. And there were definitely some people that thought Brown had won it. But for Nordenbeka to go out there and grapple for large sequences, That did impress me. In the first round of that matchup, he was able to go out there, throw a right hook, and drop TJ Brown. That was nice to see. And then, of course, his last fight, chalk it up to whatever the hell happened when he took on Derek Minner. But when you look at it for Nordenbeka, I go all the way back to a fight outside of the UFC that scares me in a matchup like this. It was his fight against Rong Zhu, where his hands drop, Rong Zhu right straight knocks him out. And that really is a tricky one against a guy like Steve Garcia. So for part and parcel, I prefer Nordenbeka's game in the matchup. I'm going with Nordenbeka. We both agree on the pick in this one. But this is a volatile matchup if I've ever seen one. And Steve Garcia has definitely come through in spots like this in the past. So it really is a tricky one for the Fight Night Picks crew. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have a big time matchup for middleweight glory in the main event. Alex Pereira making the first title defense against familiar foe Israel Adesanya. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. Always say, let's get into it. Nicholas Mata and Manuel Torres, they're gone. Coming up this weekend, a catchweight fight at 160 pounds. We have a guy whose nickname is The Cage. It's Ignacio Bahamondes out of Chile. And Matt, we've had Diego Rivas and Ignacio Bahamondes for Chilean UFC fighters. Bahamondes now taking on the Samurai Ghost. It's a weak one. Trey Ogden, the owner of Momentum Jiu-Jitsu, or Momentum MMA, rather. And for Ogden, he was due Manuel Torres. So this, again, a couple of weeks ago, Ogden cut the weight. He weighed in at 155.5 pounds. Torres couldn't make the weight on Friday, or just couldn't make the walk to the scale. So ultimately, Ogden now gets to make that dreaded double cut a couple of weeks later. 260 pounds against Bahamondes, who was due the Southpaw striking, aptly nicknamed Iron Nicholas Mata. And when you look at a matchup like this, Ogden was due a tricky Mexican first round finishing, really good boxing striker in Torres, and Bahamondes was due a southpaw striker out of Brazil in Mata. And now Bahamondes gets kind of a bad stylistic matchup, and a guy who can definitely pop the jab and work the boxing of Trey Ogden, but you see the shiny submission category in the wins column for Trey Ogden. 11 of those 16 wins are by submission, and it gives you a little bit of pause when you look at this pair.
If Trey Ogden pops the jab, he's getting lit up for 15 minutes. Trey Ogden has good boxing, but the problem is, if he uses those long-range boxing techniques, he's going to get kicked to the legs and to the body, and there are just more threats from a guy like Bahamondes. I'm not saying the things Bahamondes does well, he does as well as Ogden, but there is much more variety to the
now,
types of strikes he throws.
If you look at Bahamondes growing up in Chile, his dad was a
kickboxing
instructor. He was a WKN amateur champ coming up through. He moved to South Florida at 16 by himself, not knowing English. And then at 17, started his amateur career. And then he continued on his, what was it, third, fourth pro fight. He was losing by submission of Preston Parsons, who's a UFC welterweight that had an incredibly competitive fight in the last card against Trevin Giles. So for Bahamondes, he comes up through, face a few speed bumps, gets a giant win over on Dana White's Contender Series. And in that fight, you had Bahamondes weighing 168.5. His opponent, Gomez, 5'8", 174 pounds, a juicy boy. And it was Bahamondes' kick that was able to get him the win. Now, Bahamondes' UFC debut against an older Canadian, John McDessie.
It kind of set the game plan, though, didn't it, for a guy like Bahamondes? If you can get on the inside and disrupt some of the rhythm that he does have to generate to get his kicks involved, you can have success. But the thing about McDessie is, and I know we've ragged on him a couple times in this channel, he ate big shots in that fight, to his credit. He didn't just go down after the one big shot, because for Bahamondes, I know he lost that fight, but I don't think that's one of those fights where you lose a ton of stock from it, because he still had moments where I thought he looked decent.
Yeah, and the weirdest part about it was McDessie was over 35. He's coming off more than a year layoff off a major ACL injury. So Bahamondes, split decision loss, although majority thought that McDessie won. The fight against Roosevelt Roberts, if in 2021 you're playing along at home and you're thinking, geez, like, there were some really good knockouts in 2021. Yeah, Bahamondes against Roosevelt Roberts didn't win the big-time award, but it was definitely honorable mention. He had a really competitive first round, second round, third round. Roberts was tired, and now he's on The Ultimate Fighter with Michael Chandler and Conor McGregor. And then the last time out, Bahamondes versus Rong Zhu. Rong Zhu missed weight. That was his last fight in the UFC. Yeah. He dyed his hair pink. And then in the third round, Rong Zhu similarly got tired, gets a takedown. He kind of went really like long and army. He was able to get the double leg takedown. Bahamondes gets back up. Rong Zhu tries the same right hand into the takedown. Bahamondes gets the front choke, rolls, and then he ends up getting the submission.
But that's been the weird thing about Bahamondes. He does a lot of big actions, and he relies on kicks, and he struggles to make weight. Does he have bad cardio, though? Not really, no. Which is weird, because everything else about his game would kind of suggest that that's a pillar that would kind of crumble under any kind of pressure. But for Bahamondes, to his credit, I guess he doesn't have overwhelming kind of output, so it does help him pace himself a bit. But he does throw a lot of kicks. Again, I can't stress that enough, but he can do it into the third round, and that's why I do think the game plan of a guy like Ogden is going to be very important, because if he's dedicated to the takedown and to the grappling, I think Ogden can have a lot of success, because you know when you don't have to worry about head kicks and spinning wheel kicks? When you've got a guy on his back in his full guard, but he's going to have to eat a lot of damage, I think, in some of those longer ranges for him to get the fight to where he's comfortable at. And that's why I think this fight's a very difficult one to predict, because Bahamut, is he going to have success in the long range? Of course he is, but we have seen him get uncomfortable with guys who have good boxing, and Treyarch is not some unknown commodity on the feet. Like, he can work the jab, use the combinations into a takedown. So I think Ogden has to have a, like, 9.5 out of 10 or 10 out of 10 game plan, but I don't think he doesn't have the skills to win this fight.
Well, and I mean, for Trey Ogden, you're talking about cardio, personal trainer, owner of a gym that was formerly known as the Satellite of Glory MMA and Fitness. Now it has since switched names, but if you consider for him Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, and you look at it for a guy like Bahamundes, and it has to go with saying, he seemingly has the scar tissue of Nick Diaz or Nate Diaz, because in these last number of fights, he gets cut open, he gets bloodied. It's kind of been a bit of a staple, and especially when you have so much amateur experience in the kicking sports. And if you look at it for Trey Ogden, it's one of those ones where if he's able to mix his overall game like he did his last time out as a big underdog against Daniel Zellhuber, turn away another big prospect, This is that opportunity. But for Bahamundes, the trouble is in the Roberts fight, in the fight against Rong Zhu, Bahamundes won the first two rounds against Rong Zhu, but he tends to get tagged a lot by the jab. He tends to get hit by the 1-2s because he holds his hands out. He does hold them pretty high, but he holds them out and he gets hit right straight through that guard. And when you look at him, he also tends to duck to the left a lot, where a lot of fighters, if they catch him with an uppercut or a hook, he could get hit, he could get hurt in some of these fights. But if you do consider it and you look at the overall game of Ignacio Bahamundes, my big pluses are the kicks, not just to the body, the teep to the body, the front kick to the head.
And they're fast, not just powerful.
But I also have flexible hips, because when he throws his leg kick, there's no setup and there's no reset.
Is he a Shakira fan? Do they lie?
I don't know if they do lie, but Latin America, they know what's up. But Matt, when you look at this one, La Jaula, as I said, he is a pretty big favorite. He will switch stances, but when he switches stances, he's ambidextrous in both. He's kind of like the Pat Vendetti of MMA when I was watching his fight. So I did like that. He'd switch over to southpaw, throw boxing combinations, switch back over to orthodox, throw the same boxing combinations.
Wander Franco is my favorite switch hitter in the league. Who's yours?
Favorite switch hitter. It was always Victor Martinez way back when.
I'm thinking either Jose Ramirez or Wander Franco.
Jose can get it done. But Matt, when you do consider it in this matchup, again, Bahamundes is the favorite, Trey Ogden the underdog. We have a look at the topology votes. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say over under 80% for La Jaula.
I think they'll be over.
I think they're going to be over. You looked at these.
I haven't. I'm just getting off to a hot start.
1,043 total votes, 91% Bahamundes, 62% by knockout for the 9% that have Ogden, 69% by decision. Matt, who do you have in the matchup?
I agree with everything you said about some of the defensive liabilities that Bahamundes does have in his game, but I just think if Trey Ogden strikes with Bahamundes for 15 minutes, that's a tough way to win this fight if you're Trey Ogden.
Again, he probably won't.
If he does implement the grappling, I think he can have success. But Bahamundes is a guy who can threaten a little bit with the submissions while he is defending takedowns. He isn't just a terrible defensive wrestler. He can dig for underhooks. He is quite strong in some of those positions. So I think for those reasons, I do have Bahamundes. But I agree with a lot of the red flags that you bring up. So I do think Ogden does have an opportunity to win this fight. I just think on the feet, it's going to be a little bit too steep of a climb.
Bahamundes has good takedown defense numbers on the UFC website. Roosevelt Roberts went 0-12. Rong Zhu went 1-4. Are they giant wrestlers? No. So that's why the percentage is very, very high. With Trey Ogden, when he was going to be taking on Manuel Torres, we differed on that pick. We did, and I had Trey Ogden. And in this matchup, give me the big underdog again. I don't like the two-time weight cut all that soon, but when I do look at a guy like Trey Ogden, he has all of those things that you like against a guy in Ignacio Bahamundes. I like the takedowns out of Ogden, and even if Bahamundes is trying to crowd the space, which he tends to do, even though he has the reach advantage and the height advantage, he fights in boxing distance for being that big of a guy at lightweight. So for those reasons, I like Trey Ogden in the matchup. As flashy as Bahamundes has been, we differ on the pick. I'm going Samurai Ghost. You're going with La Jaula. A big time matchup coming up on this weekend's card. Listen, on the main card, in the co-main event, hey, Gilbert Burns is taking on Jorge Masvidal. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. It's a get right fight at strawweight coming up this weekend. The former strawweight top prospect Cynthia Calvillo is going to look to avoid a fifth straight loss when she takes on the Mexican-Canadian dynamo Lupe Godinez. And when you have a look at this matchup, Matt, This is one where I had to go down and dirty with the tape study because it's been a while since Cynthia Calvillo's picked up a win the last time, back in 2020 when she took on the retired former title challenger at flyweight, Jess Guy. In that fight, she looked really good. It had been a long time away. She looked, you know, good in that one.
It was a big opportunity, too, because it was the main event, of course. Not a lot of main events in that flyweight division at that point.
Carried the cardio well. The wrestling looked good. She then lost to Caitlin Chu Kagan, got finished by Jessica Andrade a couple months later, finished on the stool when she took on Andrea Lee, and then her last time out, lost against Nina Nunes by a split decision. That for Cynthia Calvillo. Her last camp for Nunes was actually at Syndicate MMA. She's still there for this matchup, and there's some positives that I did get out of that fight against Nunes, but when you do consider it for Cynthia Calvillo, she is ranked 15th in the women's flyweight division coming into this fight, because the UFC's rankings don't mean you can win a fight.
Never have, Craig. I've said this for years.
You can win a fight in 2020 one time, and then you're still ranked.
Why do we fire up those stuff we know, though?
When you look at the matchup, though, Matt, for Calvillo, the highest that we've seen her ranked in the UFC, this is the craziest part. She starts fighting as a pro in 2016. In 2017, Matt's pulling it up, but she fought, what, five times?
She was very active.
She came into the UFC. She was able to get wins over Amanda Bobby Cooper, Pearl Gonzalez, Joanne Wood, and then her next time out against Carla Esparza on the main card of UFC 219, Cyborg versus Holm. And in that one, yeah, that girl's nasty, but she kind of got, it was a gut check. It was style versus style, similar to what this fight is. And in the first round, Calvillo looked really good. And then in the second round and the third round, Carla Esparza was able to pull away. It was a lot of Calvillo keeping her arms out, head on the center line, getting outboxed by Esparza. And the takedowns weren't working the way that they had in those fights leading into the UFC.
This is my problem with this fight. And I'm not trying to start an argument, but I know we both have different opinions on what kind of Lupita Godinez's ceiling is in the division. I still don't know what we're going to learn if she beats Cynthia Calvillo is the weird thing. Like, if you beat Calvillo after a four-fight losing streak, I agree with you that in her last fight, she did look like she had made some improvements. But still, for Lupita Godinez, I had expected a really high ceiling for her coming into the UFC, and I don't want that to cloud some of the losses that she has had in the organization because of my own expectations for her. But my big thing is, when you reach any level of prospect in the UFC and you have a hard time with someone like Angela Hill, I do get concerned because Hill is someone who can offer a tough fight, I think we both agree this, for anybody coming off Contender Series or even in the top 15. But Angela Hill in 2022 is not sending back a lot of top-tier prospects. So for me, this is an interesting fight because it's a really important one for Godinez. I feel like a lot of people are going to look at the Cynthia Calvillo side of this and think, hey, like you had said, five-fight losing streak, what are we going to do after this? For Godinez, I thought she was going to be great coming into the UFC. We've seen little bits and flashes. The Loma Lookbunmi fight is a win that ages very well, I would say. But still, if she loses to Andrea Hill followed by Cynthia Calvillo, let's say she gets kind of on the outside of Calvillo. We see an active Calvillo who mixes in the takedown. It will leave me kind of wondering where Godinez does go after this performance.
I think it's a little ice cold. I mean, you look at it, Godinez is able to go out there, beat Vanessa Demopoulos for the LFA title, end up in the UFC, takes short notice fight against Jessica Penne. Most people thought that Godinez beat Penne. It's a loss by split decision. She picks up a performance bonus first round finish over Silvana Gomez-Juarez.
She's a 240-year-old.
She then, a week later, takes on Luana Carolina, up a weight class, has a good first round, gets tired after the first round, gets beaten the second and the third. She takes on Loma Lookbunmi and Ariane Carnelosi, wins both of them against Carnelosi, 30-27, 230-26, and then her last time against Angela Hill. The fight was announced, and it was supposed to be, and I want to make sure I get it right, it was announced that it was supposed to be October 15th, and then they moved it way up to August 13th, so it was catch weight at 120 pounds, and in that one, it was in Hill's backyard of San Diego. That was
We see Derek Lewis lose all the time at home. And away doesn't matter in MMA that much.
Yeah, it does.
You said, no, I'm going to go back. If you check the film, you said...
Jack Hermanson versus Jared Cannonier, too much pressure on Jack
Hermanson.
When Cyril
Gane fought Derek Lewis, I said, I didn't learn a lot from Cyril Gane because he beat a guy we've seen lose in his backyard, and you said, it doesn't matter.
It mattered in that instance. Now,
but
the
it doesn't
biggest
matter
part
in general.
Why would we argue on Calvillo Godinez?
No, because my whole point is, I just don't think that is a big aspect of the fight. I thought Godinez was going to be this well-rounded master when she came into the UFC, be able to mix her boxing combinations and flurries in with her jiu-jitsu, but I just haven't necessarily seen the fighter I thought we were going to get coming into the UFC.
If you remember the fight that Godinez has had against Lindsay Garbat, she even struggled at points where she was getting out-volumed on the outside and had to mix in the boxing combinations in closer. That's where Angela Hill was able to have a lot of success. But if you do look at this matchup, Matt, and you consider it for Cynthia Calvillo, I mean, she had Justin Buchholz in her corner when she was a really big favorite against Carla Esparza, and she went to Team Alpha Male. She was at AKA. She went to Extreme Couture.
And that was kind of
now
wild to see.
Syndicate.
Because she was like one of the main females at Team Alpha Male. It was her and Sarah McMahon. And they really marketed both of those heavily based on the fact that, hey, these are the two females we kind of opened the doors to. We're going to try to develop them. And Calvillo, I was really sold on as a contender. Like, I love the jiu-jitsu that we saw in her back pocket. She definitely was able to dig deep as the fights continued. But, and this isn't something that really matters in the grand scheme of things, she was such a terrible loser in that Carla Esparza fight. That was the thing. It was a close fight where you can't really argue who won, who lost. Like, Esparza was on top of Calvillo for about 70% of that fight. So, if you're Calvillo, I think it's a little difficult to cry foul, if you will. And ever since that, we haven't really seen the development, if you will, that we saw leading up to that Esparza fight.
Well, I mean, you did have Calvillo coming out against Pauliona Battaglio. She had that fight and didn't really, you know, make the weight. And then when she was going out there and took on Marina Rodriguez, 120.5 for a strawweight fight. That one, she had a 10-8 third round, if in my accord, and it is a draw on her record. But this is Calvillo's first fight at strawweight since December of 2019, and it's probably going to be an awkward one for Lupita Godinez in a way, because she's going to see Sam Hughes in the hallways of the Miami-Dade Arena, and it's a Spider-Man meme. I mean, because Godinez was able to go out there and pick up that combat game strawweight title in her amateur days over Sam Hughes. So when you do look at this one overall, Matt, it is an interesting one for Godinez. If all of her fights were at strawweight, she's had a couple of catchweights with the short notice nature of some of these fights. 24 takedowns in 6 fights. If they were all at strawweight, that would rank for 3rd all-time in strawweight history behind Carla Esparza and Claudia Gadelha. So a lot of takedowns from Godinez. She is a pretty big favorite in the matchup. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say over under 75% Godinez.
I think it'll be well over.
Well over, well over. 1,674 total votes, 87% Godinez, 85% by decision. For the 13% that have Calvillo, 76% by decision. And the reason that I said at the start of the video, Matt, that I like something that I saw to Calvillo, even though she lost her last fight, she was a lot more active on the outside, though it was against a primary striker, Nina Nunes. But Calvillo had really good movement on the outside, and she was moving her head a lot and moving her arms, not leaving her head on the center line with a lot of weight on her front foot like she had previously done, kind of fighting like a Nate Diaz. So Calvillo got away from that. Again, it is a split decision loss to Nina Nunes. The judges in that fight, Matt, scored it really weird. So you had, 30-27 Nunes, and then he had some 29-28s that were out there as well. So a really, really tricky one if you consider the scoring. But when it comes down to a matchup like this, both of these women fight stylistically quite similarly.
If you guys have ever watched our videos, you know my feelings about a fighter who moves up in weight, has success, starts to lose, then moves back down in weight. I don't like it very much. Like, you changed weight classes to begin with for a very specific reason. And what doesn't get easier as you get older? Cutting weight. It's just proven. Like, this isn't me saying it. Any fighter in the world will tell you this. So, for Calvillo, I'm a little bit concerned to see what she does look like at 115 pounds. And you bring it up. They do have a lot of similarities in their skill sets, but the one thing I will say is, Godinez is a lot more physical from a lot of those clinched positions, and I do think it'll open up her own offensive takedown. Now, is it going to be an easy fight once it hits the mat? No, of course not, because of how active a fighter like Calvillo is, but I do think the top position of Godinez is going to be strong enough for her to win this fight. Again, it's going to be kind of counterintuitive to think take a fighter like Cynthia Calvillo down because of how good her jiu-jitsu is, but a lot of that does come from tiring her opponent out, getting on top of them, and then starting to wear them down, going to the back. She has a great rear naked choke. I don't know if those positions are going to be available. For those reasons, I do have Godinez.
And when you do look at it, Godinez has done an interview with JHK over with the All-Star MMA, and in that one, she talked about the fact that she's training with the BC-based Sarah Kaufman, and after or during the fight that she had against Ariane Carnelosi, a little bit of a hip injury there, brought it into the fight against Angela Hill, so she struggled for takedowns in that one, but that fight was back last summer. So for me, I do like the younger Lupita Godinez in the matchup, but you let us know down below who you have, because it's not so cut and dry as to just one of these fighters. A big time matchup on this card coming up this weekend, Matt. Carl Williams is taking on Chase Sherman. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. If Gerald Meerschaert were a basketball team, he'd be Jason Terry's 2011 Dallas Mavericks.
How dare you not call them Dirk Nowitzki's?
If Gerald Meerschaert were a baseball team, he'd be 2019 Gerardo Parra's Washington Nationals. Wow. If Gerald Meerschaert were a football team, he'd be Tom Brady's 2002 Patriots over the Showtime Rams. Matt, Gerald Meerschaert has a history of going into the corners, getting dirty, getting his lunch pail, and getting it done and shutting down prospects.
If Mike Rowe ever retires, Gerald Meerschaert could easily host Dirty Jobs.
Coming up this weekend at middleweight, Gerald Meerschaert is looking to show the Bijo Pfeiffer crowd that you silence that hype. It's a big-time fight, and I know Gerald Meerschaert, I mean, he won the RFA middleweight title, comes into the UFC, he takes on less than stellar competition, he's able to continue to rack up wins. Joe Gigliotti was the first one. It's a first-round Anaconda choke win, performance bonus. Thank you. See you later. Check that box. Then he came up to Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. How are you, bud? Finished Newfoundland's own Ryan James by first round submission. He drops his next matchup. But for Gerald Meerschaert, Matt, he just forgets about the losses. He has the most submission wins in UFC middleweight history. And if Meerschaert's able to get a finish win over Joe Pfeiffer or just another one, he's tied for the most finishes in middleweight history with the recently or soon to be inducted into the UFC Hall of Fame, the Spider Anderson Silva. Gerald Meerschaert, kind of a big deal.
That's what I mean. Like, Gerald Meerschaert reminds me a little bit of like a one-time all-star in a lot of other sports. Like, Kenyon Martin only made one All-Star game. I loved him growing up, though. I thought he was the greatest player ever. Antoine Jameson, I think, only made one. Again, but you know what I mean? Like, there's guys who might not have reached the highest highs possible, but they still had a very memorable career along the way. And I think Gerald Meerschaert definitely matches one of those types of athletes. Because if you bring it up, can he beat anybody who's ranked? On his best day, probably, if we're being honest. Like, he just has a lot of good counters. He has surprising punching power. He has great jiu-jitsu. You don't need me to tell you about that. But that's the one concern that I do have coming into this matchup. I think Meerschaert is a very live dog, but I think a lot of people are going to look at his performance against Bruno and think, wow, so he's got that big pop in his hands. And they might give confidence to those people coming into this matchup. But I would hazard to say, if he goes in there boxing with a guy like Joe Pfeiffer, it might not be the best game plan.
So MMA math doesn't work, because Joe Pfeiffer's first time in Dana White's Contender Series, he got dropped by a slam and broke his arm against Dustin Stricefuss. And Gerald Meerschaert finished Dustin in the third round, even though Dustin won the first two rounds. So for Meerschaert, the thing that I like about watching these fights and going back and having a look, people that really hate the cross-sport comparisons, this is the video that you probably skip. So I'm sorry.
I don't think many people do.
Gerald Meerschaert, in a way, and this is a stretch, and you like to refer to this guy a lot, is like Chris Paul, just in this respect. Meerschaert slows the game down, and then his opponents fight his fight in certain matchups. So let's look at Meerschaert in the 5-on-in. He's 4-1 in his fight against Bartosz Fabinski. Bartosz goes in for his takedown, leaves his neck out. Meerschaert goes out there and submits him. The next fight, Mahmud Muradov. Absolutely.
Teed off on him for 12 minutes.
Unloads in the first round, and as the second round goes on, Mahmud gets tired and Meerschaert takes over. The next fight, Dustin Stricefuss wins the first and the second round, out-wrestles him, and then in the third round, runs out of gas, and Meerschaert's able to go out there and finish. Christoph Jocko outboxed and out-wrestled Gerald Meerschaert.
To be fair, though, that is somewhat expected. Like, Jocko's one of those guys who does a lot of everything, so he does have more activity than a guy like Meerschaert.
Didn't do enough of everything last weekend with the PFL. And then, Gerald's last time out, he beats Splendato Bruno Silva. And you might go, hey, Bruno, bad taste in my mouth. I don't like Bruno Silva anymore. Trust me. Nice. I was the biggest Bruno Silva guy. Bruno didn't look like normal Bruno's last time out. I don't know if it's because he grew out the dad goatee and shaved his head. He thought he was Walter White
like
for some reason.
Kikuchi with a beard?
But his hands were down. He looked really tired in the first round. The second round, he didn't look good.
He got lit up.
And then in the third round, he got hit by a really, really tough right by Gerald Meerschaert. And in that one exchange, I mean, Meerschaert wins the first round, wins the second round, won that third round. And out of it, it was like, it was all over. The left hook was into the knockdown, and Bruno was like, hands behind his back, knees.
He felt like Peter Griffin.
It was a public execution. So Gerald Meerschaert gets the win out there. Meerschaert's a guy, he gets a lot of bonuses. And for him, the interesting thing about Meerschaert too is that longtime Rufus Sport guy, so you're going to hear him this fight week, assuming so. He's going to pump C-Rod a lot. That's on the main card, Christian Rodriguez. And he has for a really long time, but he switched things up with his training. He's trained with Philly Fresh, Phil Rowe down at Fusion XL, Adolfo Vieira in this camp, Killcliff FC, and I'll throw a couple of pictures up there of his training camp. Guys like Ung Lun Song, guys like Brandon Allen, they're going to get you ready for a guy like Joe Pyfer.
Yeah.
And for Pyfer, I know I've talked a lot about Meerschaert. Pyfer's one of those guys, my favorite shot that he throws. He kind of goes to the wall a little bit too much with it, but I still love it. Jumping hook to the body with that left hook.
So nice.
He mixes his boxing in from the body to the head. He's not a giant leg kicker.
And that's the thing. When Pyfer does start to fight some of those top 15 guys who have a high variety of strikes, I do think I will start to have concern with him. But when he's fighting guys in the middleweight division, like, we both agree on this. I don't think the middleweight division is the best division in the UFC right now.
Oh, it's the worst.
Yeah, exactly. Like, middleweight, heavyweight, light heavyweight, they're not great right now compared to where they were at one point. So, for Joe Pyfer, having amazing boxing with really good power and just like good enough takedown defense to get you there is probably good enough to get him a ranked opponent at some point. But again, and I can't stress this enough, if you have a singular weakness in your game, Gerald Meerschaert's the guy who is going to drag it out of you.
And for Pyfer on Contender Series the second time, he took on Ozzy Diaz, a very, very good boxer, completely outclassed him on the feet, was able to take him down.
And Diaz is a good fighter. I actually think Diaz is a guy who's going to end up in the UFC sooner rather than later.
Pyfer made it look really easy, and then the UFC said, okay, you did us a favor in that episode, we're gonna sign a guy. So his first time out, they gave him Alan Amadovsky.
And you're they gave him to him.
Who had lost three fights in a row, two of them by first round finish, and Joe Pyfer knocked him out. Now Pyfer was almost a 6-1 favorite. They gave Joe a performance bonus for that one. It was like taking a beach ball and putting it into a pitching machine at 20 miles an hour with a giant ephus, and then he just hit it off. He was able to hit it. So good for Joe Pyfer, giant win there, obviously confidence booster. But to go from a guy like Amadovsky to then jump up and fight a guy in Gerald Meerschaert, that obviously is a big jump. But for Pyfer, training out of, John Marquez, MMA, and of course the adjacent Daniel Gracie, with Sean Brady, with some big names like Andre Petrosky, Petrosky's equally going to get you ready for a guy like Gerald Meerschaert.
This is what concerns me, though. For Pyfer, he reminds me of a player who has a really high floor, but potentially a low ceiling because of it. Like, I think Joe Pyfer, based on the fundamental skill set he has right now, the great power he has, the takedown ability and defense that he has, and of course the great boxing, in combination too, and that's the thing. Big guys don't always throw in combination because naturally they will have knockout power, but the thing I like about Pyfer is he doesn't get off balance trying to overthrow his shots because he does often throw in combinations. So he's a guy who can throw very fast and immediately get his hands down to defend some types of takedowns. So I think for those reasons, I like where Pyfer could fall into the division overall, but I am a little bit concerned. Like, when he starts fighting guys like Roman Dolidze, Marvin Vettori, Robert Whittaker, I know we're talking about guys at the top of the division, but still, those guys have multiple mixed martial arts they can go to when they really need to get a win. And for Pyfer, I do worry a little bit about his variety as he continues to move up the division.
And he does have that submission loss back in 2019 to Jonathan Potty, a guy who was pottied onto a poster against one Jamie Pickett. So Matt, for Pyfer, he is the favorite in the matchup. He did wrestle back in high school. I talked about it. I said he doesn't kick the legs all that much, but when he hits that calf, boy, does he make it count. But Joe Pyfer was the Central League Championships Outstanding Wrestler back in 2015 with Pencrest. Way to be Joe Pyfer. Matt, we have a look at the Tapology votes, the fan vote. My guess is as good as yours. I'm going to say over under 77.5%.
I've caught myself in the back. My guess has been pretty good. I'm going to guess over.
Yeah, you looked at all of it. Ooh.
Under.
No, you didn't.
No,
1,710 total votes. 54% Pyfer.
I like the split.
79% by knockout for the 46% that have GM3. 74% by submission. Amount for Gerald Meerschaert, I mean, in the UFC, he is 10-7. The losses: Shamayev, Heinisch, Anders, Holland, Jocko, as I mentioned earlier, Hermanson, and PFL's Thiago Santos, who wasn't able to get the win over Rob Wilkinson. So Matt, when you look at this fight, it is a tough one to pick, But what is the pick?
Anybody who's watched this channel knows that there's a big part of me that wants to go with Gerald Meerschaert in this fight. I just think Joe Pfeiffer is better than some of the prospects he has fought in the past. I think he does have sort of the game plan B to what Mahmoud Muradov went in there with. Muradov's a guy who has tremendous punching power, will throw with a lot of accuracy and aggression, but he will run out at a certain point, and Pfeiffer doesn't have that level of aggression. I don't think he's going to punch himself out per se. I think he won't land damaging shots throughout the fight, because here's the thing, Gerald Meerschaert's not hard to find. Like, Muradov, I know he got tired as the fight went on, but he landed double-digit fight-ending shots in that matchup. Gerald Meerschaert just has a great chin. I'm just worried about that at 35 years of age after fighting a lot of top competition. So, Gerald Meerschaert has a great chance to win. I'm not discrediting that whatsoever. I just think Joe Pfeiffer, he's going to be able to land some of those power shots.
Joe Pfeiffer made his amateur debut just a couple of weeks before Gerald Meerschaert made his UFC debut. So that's kind of wild. But for Pfeiffer, the only thing I disagree with is back at the Amadovsky fight, he was throwing everything to knock him out, off balance. He was trying to cut the cage with hooks following.
He was a minus 700 favorite, and he knew if he landed one shot, the fight was over.
Old Allen.
It's just like, we have seen guys fight out of themselves in their big favorite. Anthony Joshua fought last night. I know none of you guys know because it wasn't against anybody good, but my whole point is, when you're a big favorite, you can get away with making those mistakes. I don't think Pfeiffer's going to do that against a guy like Meerschaert.
I will go with Joe Pfeiffer in the matchup. I do like the defense of wrestling some of these shots, but boy, oh boy, you're asking for a bad night if you're trying to defensively wrestle against Joe Meerschaert. Both of us going with Philly Fresh, Philly's own body bags, Joseph Pfeiffer. I was going to say Gerald Meerschaert. Matt, a big-time matchup on this card. You look at this overall middleweight landscape, and the title's on the line in the main event. It's Pereira defending against Adesanya. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. The April Fool's, non-April Fool's joke. It was reported by Marcel Dorf. He doesn't joke around about fight announcements. That out was Beast Boy Chris Barnett in his U.S. Virgin Islands own Carl Williams. And he's going to be taking on the Vanilla Gorilla Chase Sherman. Matt, it's a really weird matchup because if you consider for Carl Williams, I did listen to an interview that he had done with. Try and guess who did the interview with him.
Either JHK or James Lynch.
It was JHK before his fight against Łukasz Drzeski. And in that
one, two of our favorites,
Carl Williams talked about the fact that he was able to build himself up to heavyweight the right way. He was able to put on muscle mass. He was able to increase his bone density with the help of the UFC PI. And out of all of that, it seems like heavyweight is the future. And he weighed 233 against Jimmy Lawson on Dana White's Contender Series. Took that fight on incredibly short notice. Jimmy Lawson, Penn State product, one of the best pure wrestlers you're going to find out there in the heavies. And Carl Williams took him down three times and totally dominated. Almost 11 minutes of control time in that fight. So Williams goes out there, takes on Drzewski, and in that one, does the exact same thing, and even drops Drzewski in that fight. So for Williams, the scary thing is, halfway through the second round, there was like a point where Herb Dean had to check his glove, and then he put his hands on his knees, and Daniel Cormier was like, his hand's on his knees, he's tired! And Williams gets back
up. And then he 10-8'd him in the third round.
He did a Patrick Roy, and he kind of put his hands up, like, I want out of here. But for Carl Williams, a big win there against Drzewski. That fight, 3 weeks ago. So now he's taking this fight on really short notice. Williams kind of switched things up. He's an ATT Atlanta adjacent guy. He's trained with the Lima brothers. Diego Lima, somebody out there that's listening to this, I need to put this out into the world. I've searched Diego Lima Creed 3, I don't know how many times, on how many social media platforms. If you watch the part where Creed's getting ready for the fight against his friend, you look at the training montage. Diego Lima is the guy holding the pads. He's the guy in the corner. So Diego Lima, I'm pretty sure he's in that, but he doesn't have social media anymore. So,
wait, you've seen the third. Is it good, first of all?
Yeah, there's a lot of weird parts about that fight. We can get into it, but
I really like the first two Creed.
In the matchup, Matt, Carl Williams, very, very good with his wrestling. But the reason I bring up the weight is the fact that in his amateur days, he went 5-1 from 2019 to 2020. He was 3 at light heavyweight, 3 at heavyweight as a pro, 6 of 9 fights at light heavyweight. So I do like the move up to heavyweight for him. He was a part of the 2022 PFL Challenger Series, as was Yanal Ashmoz, and both guys able to pick up wins in their respective UFC debuts. So Carl Williams comes into this one, I assume, in the last 3 weeks, that he's been training at ATT Atlanta. But for his last one, a lot of time spent at Extreme Tour with a lot of those big boys. And I would think training with guys like Sergey Spivak, they're probably going to get you ready for a matchup like this. Or Ngannou, or whoever it is. But for Chase Sherman, he was getting ready for Beast Boy, a guy that's going to strike on the outside, that's going to rally back like he did his last time out against Jake Collier. Sherman's had the weirdest runs in the UFC, and now he's looking for the first win since that time against Jared Vandera. He's 1-4 in his last 5 UFC contests.
This is my big issue with this fight, and I'm not saying this to poke fun at Chase Sherman or anything like that, but Chase Sherman excels when he's fighting a primary striker. I think we can both agree to that. He's going to make the fight very fun. He has surprising output for a heavyweight. Like, he doesn't get tired in the third round. This guy will throw a lot.
About a third of his strikes are leg kicks, too.
Exactly. And that's the thing about Chase Sherman. He's an active guy who will throw in combination, throw kicks and whatnot. But the thing is, even when he's fighting a primary striker, do we tend to pick Chase Sherman in these matchups? Like, guys who are going to give him a lot of moments in the thing he's really good at. You haven't answered me yet, so I don't love the answer. That's my whole issue. Like, with Chase Sherman, if he's going to go out there and fight a guy like Chris Barnett, I can give you an in-depth breakdown as to, hey, Barnett's going to throw some big actions. He might not be the most active guy in the in-betweens. And that's going to give a guy like Chase Sherman a lot of opportunities to win that fight.
Now, I picked Sherman's last time out against Cortez Acosta because Cortez Acosta struggled so bad against the leg kicks of Jared Vandera. I thought Vandera won the fight. I thought Chase Sherman won the fight. But the weirdest part about that fight is Chase Sherman couldn't figure out the movement, had less output than normal, threw less kicks than normal, and this is another camp out of Killcliffe FC like his last one.
And Carl Williams is going to put those question marks into your mind as to, hey, when is it safe to throw my strikes? When can I not and try and defend the takedown? Because Williams is a guy who, when he gets in on the takedown, he's going to chain wrestle. He's not just going to let go of it, let you be, and then, okay, now we're going to restart. So Sherman is a heavyweight who moves very well. I think we both would agree on that. He has good footwork, but he damn well better have good footwork if he's fighting Carl Williams, because Williams has shown power in some of his previous fights, but I don't think he's going to go into this fight trying to brawl with a guy like Sherman, because that leaves the window open for Sherman to win this fight. If Williams just goes in there and wrestle, and I know that's an easier said than done type of a game plan, because Sherman's going to throw a lot of damaging strikes again. The movement is going to help this takedown defense. I still don't know what Sherman's going to be able to do outside of the brawling to help him win this fight.
If you look at it for Carl Williams, and we continue to talk about how good his MMA wrestling is, because it has been ex-MMA, UFC, Contender Series, PFL. If you look at it for Williams, what's his base? Like Sam Hughes, track and field at South Carolina State. So I'll throw the picture up there for that one.
But he's 6'3 and weighs 240. It like, does, you shouldn't be able to run that far.
And he looked kind of tired his last time out. But again,
he looked good as the fight went on. Again, the wrestling is so dominant that if he gets that top position, if you can't get back up to your feet, you are going to be just as spent as he is.
It really is weird. So again, for Sherman, by the numbers, last time out against Cortez Acosta, significant strikes, 147 to 66. He was able to land 25 leg kicks in that one. He had 33 against Parker Porter and 25 against Andre Arlovski. He's able to get those numbers up. The takedown defense actually throughout the UFC run. And the UFC run for Chase Sherman, 2-5 the first time, 1-3 the second time. Then he asked for his release. He was going to go back. He was a 2019 BKFC Police Gazette heavyweight champ. He wanted to go back and compete for those belts. But he ended up getting signed back in the UFC, 1-2 in this recent stint. But if you consider it, he's been taken down by Romanov Collier. Collier out of that weird one where he submitted him. Porter, Sakai, and Willis. Big, pretty, go home. It's been a long time since then. But when you look at the matchup, Matt, Carl Williams coming in on really short notice is a giant favorite. Yeah. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprised us there to you. I'm going to say over under 95% Carl Williams.
You said it high. I'll say under, but I still think it'll be over like 85.
Oh, you dog. 347 total votes, 94% Williams, 65% by decision for the 6% that have Sherman, 45% by decision, 35% by knockout. Carl Williams in the second round against Łukasz Drzewski left giant openings for his opponent to take care of him. And Williams had his hands down. Drzewski had his hands down. Drzewski was belly breathing. Williams was belly breathing. But for Chase Sherman, he does have decent cardio for the heavyweight division. And he's obviously strongest in the first round. I know how many first round finishes he does have.
But you'd agree with me with this, though. Sherman's not a one-punch, like, hit-or-quitter guy. Like, he will use an accumulation
especially his fight against Ike Villanueva.
And that's what we're... Like, if he had more one-punch knockout ability, I would think he has a chance in this fight. But the fact that he does have to kind of build towards the finish, especially on the feet, does make me a little bit concerned about, okay, how much time is he going to get to develop a rhythm before he gets taken down? Because, again, every time he gets back up, I know his range is going to be a little bit better, but you're going to have to reset to get back into some of those positions to where you're really going to feel comfortable. And for those reasons, that's why I do have Carl Williams. If you want to comment, hey, short notice, I'm a little bit concerned about the weight, the size advantage that Chase Sherman has. I'm not going to say you're dumb by any means. I just think the foundational skill of Carl Williams and his MMA wrestling, and I'm happy you said it like that, because his MMA wrestling, he might not be some Olympic gold medalist, but he does have phenomenal MMA wrestling. I think it'll carry him.
There was a quotable in there that I'm going to put on a t-shirt. That'll MMA be for wrestling. The next one. I'm not saying you're dumb, but, and for Carl Williams, at the MMA wrestling of TJ Dillashaw, I mean, Matt Allen pretty much said it, but when you look at this one, I do like Williams for all of the skills that he possesses. The line definitely scares me. Yeah. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in the matchup. We're both in agreement with U.S. Virgin Islands' own Carl Williams to get the win. Some big-time matchups left on this card, Matt. I mean, we have Michelle Watterson-Gomez taking on Luana Pinheiro in the next matchup.
And I feel like Kelvin Gastelum, Chris Curtis is a fight that has not been talked about enough.
And we're going to talk about it here, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Big time implications at strawweight. Luana Pinheiro representing Brazil looking for her first bit of action since 2021, taking on the former Invicta atomweight champ. You know her the best. It's the karate hottie Michelle Watterson, somebody who is no stranger to a main event or co-main event under the UFC's bright lights. But Matt, when I look at a fight like this, it's a little bit like drinking lead to pool. In April. It's a bit of a weird matchup.
Where do you get eggnog this time of the year is my question.
You got to have Baxter Connections. Baxter.
Craig knows a guy in the eggnog industry.
The weirdest part is, if you're in New Brunswick, Canada right now, you go to Walmart, you go to a grocery store, for some reason, yeah, they have 1 liter cartons of eggnog, and I'm a big fan. But Matt, when you look at this matchup, for Michelle Watterson Gomez, as she goes by now, it's 1-4 in the last five. Three of those fights are main events. And if you go down through the main events, one's Joanna, one's an Angela Hill fight of the night win. And then the other one that you have, it's a co-main event against Michelle Rodriguez. And the other one, a main event against Amanda Lemos. So three main events, one co-main event. And I think I said the wrong name. I meant to say Marina Rodriguez. But if you go down through and you look at these, the level of competition for Michelle Watterson Gomez, with the exception of the first two fights that she had in the UFC, are over pretty good competition.
We might disagree on this, and that's fine, but I gotta be honest, even when Michelle Watterson was on her rise to the title, I was never totally sold on her as a contender, and this is why.
She never fought for the title.
No, on her rise to the title, though. Like, if she beat Ioane and Jacek in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, she was probably gonna fight for the title. My point was, she won on a big Fox card. Like, those big Fox cards were a big deal at one point. I know we might kind of forget about those now that we're in the ESPN era, but that wasn't a regular fight night. That was a Fox card that happened three times a year.
That was a Fox card that featured Michelle Watterson Gomez beating Paige VanZant and Sage Northcutt, Emo Sage, yeah, taking on Mickey Gall, and in the co-main event.
My whole point is, and if you guys in the comments want to get after me, I'm here for the hate. Who was the best fighter Michelle Watterson beat on her way up? Karolina Kowalkiewicz in 2019 was not in her prime. Felice Herrig was not ever a real contender. Courtney Casey was never really looked at as a contender. And I've got news for you guys. I genuinely thought Courtney Casey had won that fight because she threatened a lot more with submissions off her back. My whole point is, the real question mark in this fight for me is, where is Michelle Watterson in her career? She's 37 years old. We haven't seen a lot of fighters at 115 pounds really excel at this stage of their careers. My point is, though, I never really thought that highly of Michelle Watterson on her rise to the title, and that's why I have a hard time picking her in this matchup. I rarely start a video out this kind of one-sided towards a fighter. I just don't know what Michelle Watterson has left to give, to be honest, at the top level of competition.
Throws volume on the outside, Luana Pinheiro doesn't move her head on the center line, and gets kicked to the body like it's going out of business.
You're right
by
on all
side kicks that Michelle Watterson Gomez excels.
This is
in
my point, though. Nobody is concerned about the power of Michelle Watterson Gomez at this stage of her career. If you walk forward on those side kicks, yes, they're going to push you back, but for the most part, Michelle Watson Gomez does not have a lot of legitimate finishing power in her skill set. I know the kicks are very pretty, the jiu-jitsu is good when she's able to get it there, but the problem with Watson Gomez is it wrestling great? No. She relies a lot on those head and arm throws with her judo, so if she can get this fight into the clinch, I think she could have success. That's just really been my problem with Watson Gomez. Her jiu-jitsu is good, her striking is much talked about, but her wrestling has always been the thing that does concern me.
Well, and for Watson Gomez, you talk about judo. Luani Pinheiro is a judo black belt. Her father's a judo master, and that's the foundational element of Luani Pinheiro.
Would you agree with me, though? Like, Watson Gomez is not a bad grappler by any means, but she does rely a lot on those head and arm throws from the judo position. She never goes for single leg or double leg takedowns, so I do think the one area of her game that can get her to where she can succeed is really going to be countered a lot by Pinheiro, like you would mention.
What's your favorite bit of media that Michelle Watson Gomez has been in throughout her career?
I have no idea.
Bully Beatdown?
Bully Beatdown was a wild show, kind of.
Or American Ninja Warrior. Bounced early on that.
You remember the show Wipeout? Wipeout I thought was pretty fun to watch, but I never got into American Ninja Warrior.
Do you think people at their house buy eggnog and decide to put it in gold tins with little tiny cups?
There's one person in New Brunswick who's like, I know what that is. I'm drinking it right now.
Yeah, there might be. But when you do look at this one, for Watson Gomez, longtime Jackson Wink MMA affiliate. She did leave for a brief period of time. Much publicized, but she does train with Holly Holm and Arlene Blenkow. You know, Danger Fist. Anger Fist.
At 37, I genuinely do have concerns.
Luana Pinheiro, though, you do look at it, and every win but a one. I mean, we're talking just so many first-round finishes for Luana Pinheiro. And I should say, she does have that DQ win against Randa Marcos. One that she was doing the head and arm throw, It was an illegal upkick that looked like it knocked her out from the broadcast team. She has two decision wins, but all of these wins are coming in the first round when she's able to get them done. The level of competition was quite poor coming into Dana White's Contender Series, and then it was quite poor in Dana White's Contender Series. She took on 8-6 Stephanie Frost, though, who's now 8-9. Then the Marcos fight, then Sam Hughes. And in the Sam Hughes fight, first time we've really seen her go late into a matchup against a UFC-level competition where both threw incredibly low output. And in my mind, Pinheiro was able to win two of those three rounds. Pinheiro was originally due Jessica Penne last year. Penne withdrew from the fight. So again, this is Pinheiro's first action since 2021. She trains at Nova Uniao. Obviously, that kind of partnership and life partnership with Mateusz Nicolau. But Dede Pedernales is the head corner. When you go down through it, again, all eight finishes in the first round. The thing that weirds me out, like, I do like the third round showing that she had against Sam Hughes.
Exactly.
She
I learned a lot of that.
That kind of answered and checked a lot of boxes. But for Pinheiro, a lot of big actions early when you go for a lot of those judo throws. And her top pressure isn't necessarily the best considering the lineage and the finishes that she does possess.
Watson Gomez became a top contender because she beat Paige VanZant on a Big Fox card after she beat Angela Magana in her UFC debut. If this was the lightweight division, the bantamweight division, or the featherweight division, you'd have to win, what, 9 fights in a row to get to that position?
Yeah, but that was the premier division. It's the best one right now.
What?
Women's strawweight's been long the best division MMA.
So hot right now. My point is, though, for Watson Gomez, it's the best division of women's MMA because it's the deepest, but I wouldn't say it has the top-tier talent, that's all. My whole point is, for Watson Gomez, I think she can have success if she is able to get this fight to the mat, actually, because she is a fighter who's very active from those positions. What?
The karate hottie, the army.
He's 37 and hasn't looked
great
in a while. Has
1.7 million Instagram followers. Luana Pinheiro has 100,000, so it is a night and day there.
Instagram followers won fights, then
Pinheiro is a decent favorite in the matchup. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprised us there to you. I'm going to say over under 80% for the Brazilian in the matchup.
I think they'll be under.
I think they're going to be under, and they're under. 1,662 total votes, 74% Pinheiro, 80% by decision. She's won 10 fights. 8 of them are by finish for the 26% that have Watson Gomez, 87% by decision. The UFC definitely did her dirty her last time out against Lemos. But in this matchup, Matt, Pinheiro, she stands on the outside. She waits. She keeps her hands kind of chest height. She doesn't accept those body kicks all that well. We talked about Marlon Vera's guard where he's able to bring his hands down to block a lot of
the
body punches.
His defense,
and then he can bring him up. He can bring him down. He almost has a boxing defense. Pinheiro, that's just the hand height, and that's what you get, because obviously the judo shines, and that's that foundational skill again. Pinheiro will pump the jab out there, but tends to hit on air with that. The right hand will land out of it. Doesn't tend to throw a lot of kicks. She doesn't have much volume to her striking. She does have nice power, but she doesn't have a lot of volume behind it. Waterson Gomez does, although she does have a negative striking clip in the UFC with all
the
experience.
I think the Joanna fight, though, has a lot to do with that.
That she has 6-6 in the UFC for Waterson Gomez, that bully beatdown star. Smat, again, Pinedo's favored. We haven't seen her in quite some time. Who do you have to win this fight? You really let the cat out of the bag early.
I did, but here's that. Like, it is a difficult fight to predict because, again, I'm not completely sold on Pinedo as some, like, top-tier prospect. And I think that is fair to say. If you beat someone like Michelle Waterson Gomez, I'm not saying we don't learn anything about you. I think that is a very good step to becoming a genuine contender. But until we do see this fight, I think it is fair to say that there's genuine concerns about Luana going forward. But I do have her in this matchup for all the reasons I brought up. I think you do bring up a very reasonable concern. Though the sidekicks of someone like Waterson Gomez could give her a lot of issues from the outside, but that's why I brought up Waterson Gomez, and you saw this in the Joanna fight. I know that's not necessarily the best example using one of the best fighters in the division, but still, Joanna said, okay, you can do all that movement, be cute on the outside, I'm gonna put my hands up like this and walk forward and just beat you down as I get closer to you.
It's not Pinedo's game, though.
I know it's not, but how is Waterson gonna win this fight? Either volume kicking from the outside, which is a pretty difficult way to win a 15-minute decision, or, which I believe is user grappling, and I do think she can have success with that. I just think Pinedo is going to be able to counter a lot of that grappling, and for those reasons, I do have Luana, but again, this is a very close fight.
I like Pinedo with those throws, and yeah. If it does get into a clinch, I favor in the matchup. Waterson Gomez with the volume could definitely get it done. Matt, the other member of my household, will not be able to drink the eggnog now because I backwashed into it. Enjoy Christmas, Joyeux Pâques, because that's coming up, and Matt, a big time matchup in this women's strawweight division with both of us going with Brazil's Luana Pinedo. We have a big-time matchup in the next fight, Matt. I mean, Chris Curtis is taking on Kelvin Gastelum. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Top 15 middleweight square off on the prelims. We have Kelvin Gastelum looking to pick up his first win since UFC 258, taking on Extreme Couture's The Action Man, Chris Curtis. 4-1 in the 5-on-in for Chris Curtis. But for Kelvin Gastelum, you got to start off at the start off. He came in off the Ultimate Fighter. He wins the season. He's the boy wonder. But then you look at the recent string of success, and again, for Gastelum, he's 1-4 in the 5-on-in. He was supposed to take on Nasruddin Imavov back in January, wasn't able to make the walk, had the facial injury, lost a tooth, got it fixed, had the big sore on his face. I don't know if that was staph infection. He did have staph infection getting ready for UFC 234 against Robert Whittaker, but Whittaker pulled out due to a hernia, so the fight got canceled. But Gastelum struggled with that in the past. But if you look at it, January 25th, not long after, Gastelum tweeted it out, and he announced this fight between him and Chris Curtis. So Curtis, last time out, knocked off a foe. You want to talk a foe. There was Taylor Swift. There was like Ryan Adams covering Taylor Swift bad blood. So for Chris Curtis, he goes out there. He's tentative in the first round. He's tentative in the second round until he goes out there and picks up that knockout. From Chris Curtis, in a fight like this against Kelvin Gastelum, Gastelum's going to bring the pressure. And that's where Curtis shines. Because Curtis, will he walk you down? Not in every fight. But will he counter-strike and throw some power and mix it into some of those boxing combinations? You know that he will. And Chris Curtis, from his stance, we talk about this. Could you pick the silhouette with the fighter? Chris Curtis.
High shoulders?
High shoulder, looks like a boxer, walk guys down in MMA. So, Matt, when you look at the matchup like this for Gastelum, it's easy to say. If he fought like he did in his last win against Ian Heinisch, goes out there and puts on the wrestling shoes.
If he fought like he did against Darren Till, I think he'd have a good chance.
Yeah, I mean, for Gastelum against a guy like Curtis, what has Curtis struggled with throughout his career? Wrestling. And lack of volume, but wrestling.
I even think the pressure, though, of a guy like Kelvin Gastelum, because I agree with you. Chris Curtis is a phenomenal counter striker. He has great hooks on the inside, which
you
is
know
weird.
He watches the channel, so you gotta mind your P's and Q's.
No, I think Chris Curtis has a ton of strengths to his game, but the weird thing is, I really think Chris Curtis is gonna need either A, knockdowns to win this fight to kind of make up for the difference in output, or finish a guy like Kelvin Gastelum. I was kind of making the joke to you before we started filming. My buddy Tim, who's got probably too many shoutouts on this channel, every time Kelvin Gastelum seems to fight, I'm like, this might be the one where his chin does get tested, you know? He seems to get wobbled in every single fight, but he never really goes down. I'm kind of at the point now where I have no idea what's going to knock out Kelvin Gastelum, to be honest. Like, we've seen Israel Adesanya land 360 elbows into, like, left hooks, and he goes down, but he's still pretty conscious, and that's the wild thing. I think for Chris Curtis, does he have all the skills to win this fight? Of course he does, but I thought Robert Whittaker was going to finish Kelvin Gastelum. He wasn't able to do it. I thought Darren Till could finish Kelvin Gastelum. He wasn't able to do it. Just every time I feel like I want to completely sell my stock on Kelvin Gastelum, he looks a little bit better in a loss than I kind of expected him to. And that's why I have a hard time with this fight. Because for Chris Curtis, we know that when he fights the sort of top tier guys, maybe he doesn't have enough. We saw that in the Jack Hermanson fight. Hermanson won with the output, which is kind of weird because Hermanson's definitely known for being more of a grappler. Even though he does have good output, I'm not saying that to discredit his striking. But for Chris Curtis, you don't see him getting outstruck by Jack Hermanson and then think, okay, he's going to beat Robert Whittaker after that. But I think this matchup against Kelvin Gastelum is going to leave the door open for him to land a lot of his counter shots, because Gastelum is going to have to move forward in this fight, and I don't know if he's really been able to say that in his last number of fights.
No,
because everybody else has brought the fight to him.
The Gastelum fight that I go back to when I look at a fight against Chris Curtis, okay, let's think of southpaws that he's fought. You have the one against Darren Till, you have Vitor Belfort, Johnny Hendricks, and Rick Story. So out of those, Gaslam's 3-1.
Kingmare switches, though.
I go back against old... I said Till, Vitor,
Hendricks... No, I was just saying, like, Cannoneer had a lot of success in the southpaw with the leg kick, and
Cannoneer that's all. Will switch, and so will Israel Adesanya. But when you go back and you look at Kelvin's fight against Vitor Belfort, I just got to take a second for just
Vitor
one second. Just a second. Vitor was 39. Last night, Vitor was 46 years old and beat Jacare Souza. Matt, I'm going to say a sentence that's factual. Remember the time the guy in the Wheaties box beat a 56-year-old Roy Jones Jr.?
Can't be touched, can't be stopped, can't be moved, can't be rocked.
Like, that really happened.
We hot, Craig.
That really happened. But if you look at it for Kelvin Gastelum and the fight that he had against Vitor Belfort, who was... His head was shit. He didn't look like the same.
But that wasn't
he
Vitor.
He did have Shogun Hua trunks, and boy, were they teensy-weensy. But if you look at Gastelum in that fight... In the first round, he throws a right hook and a left straight.
Was he puffing, though, Craig?
Yeah, that was the trouble.
He was puffing.
So he gets the first knockdown, right hook, left straight.
It's beautiful.
Vitor gets back up, and he's bloodied. And then Gastelum throws, like, it looked like a 60% 1-2. And it drops Vitor, and that's the end of the fight. There's
he
like
did a great job moving his feet, though, closing the distance, is what I will say.
There's a delayed reaction, but... Now there's a big but. That's a no contest on Kelvin Gastelum's record. Again, I consider it a win. If NBA players in 2023 can rip the reefer, then Kelvin Gastelum picked up a win in that fight against Vitor Belfort.
I'm Canadian in 2023. If you think I care that an MMA fighter smoked weed before a fight, you're out of your mind. But what I will say is, this is a bit of an interesting reset for a guy like Gastelum, because Chris Curtis, we talked about this with like Dustin Jacoby for a while, he is sort of that like 16th ranked fighter. So
the guy's 9-1 in his last 10 fights.
That's my point. For Gastelum, even if he loses this, it's not saying Gastelum has nothing left. You know what I mean? But it is fair to say that if you lose to Chris Curtis, it's no longer you losing to Jared Cannonier or Robert Whittaker or Darren Till. It will be a bit of a step back. So for Gastelum, this is a really important fight in his career. And I know he hasn't had a lot of inconsequential fights, but this is a very important one.
For Curtis, he did get that performance bonus his last time out. And you talk southpaw versus southpaw. Curtis fought southpaws in the past, and he's fought good grapplers. Hermanson went 0-6 on takedown attempts in their fight. Brennan Allen really tried to sync things up with that early submission attempt. Curtis able to shock him off and then go out there and put him down to the canvas. But if you look at it for Gastelum, the interesting thing is, since he joined the UFC, 6 main events and 8 co-main events. 7 5-round fights, because his fight against Adesanya was a co-main event for the title. And out of all of those fights, all of the 5-round fights, Cannonier is a loss, Whittaker is a loss, Adesanya is a loss, Bisping is a win, Weidman's a loss.
Vitor also just fought GSP.
Vitor is a win to me. And then in his fight against Neil Magny, that's a loss. But if you look at it, he struggled in 5-round fights. But in 3-round fights, Gastelum looks pretty darn fresh in these fights.
I don't know the answer to this, but it is an interesting question. And I should send a fighter who follows me on Instagram a DM, so I'm going to do that after this. But do you think fighting in a lot of 5-round atmospheres can kind of mess with your pacing over time? I've never really thought of that until right now, if I'm being completely honest with you. I am concerned that if Gastelum is too used to kind of a 25-minute atmosphere, that kind of getting back into a 15-minute fight is a little bit interesting. That's all. It's an interesting point that I've never really thought about.
This guy's not a one-pump chump. He can go 25 rounds. When you look at it for Gastelum, though, has switched things up recently. If you did look at it, I mean, getting ready for the fight against Imavov, he's been at fight ready for quite some time with Eddie Cha and Santino DeFranco, so eager to see how that plays out in a matchup against Chris Curtis, who has some similarities to Nasrin Imavov. They're big, they're tall, they strike at range, but when you do look at the odds, Matt, Gastelum ever so slightly favored. We have a look at the Tapology vote, surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say over under 65% Gaslam.
I think it'll be over.
It's under. 1,780 total votes. 73% of the underdog Curtis, 64% by decision, 28% by knockout. For the 27% that have Gaslam, 83% by decision. This is where it gets really weird, Matt, because Chris Curtis corners a lot of fighters at Extreme Tour.
We love that.
We love that. Now, who did he corner? Sean Strickland, who replaced Kelvin Gastelum against Nasrdin Imavov. Who picked Nasrdin Imavov? Not this guy, but that doesn't matter. I had Gastelum to beat Imavov, and then I had Strickland to beat Imavov. I feel like I've got a good read on a guy like Kelvin Gastelum, even though the 1 and the 4 and the 5 on in, and Chris Curtis is the inverse.
Yeah.
When you look at this matchup, though, Matt, Gaslam's wrestling X factor that we only see sometimes.
I don't think we will. I just don't.
And if he boxes, he's really tricky when he gets into the pocket and he decides to mix in the lead uppercut and then his left hook. I'm eager to see what kind of volume numbers we get out of Curtis. And if Curtis decides that he's willing to accept the backup, because again, out of that one loss that he has in the 5-1 into Jack Hermanson, you consider the fight against Vieira, he was able to kind of work the pressure at the start, and then as it went on, it wasn't necessarily the
most
appeasing fight.
Can Adolfo box like Kelvin Gastelum?
No.
Exactly.
But Curtis was able to kind of pull away with the volume on the outside. I don't know what version of Gastelum you're going to get in this one myself.
You want to feel like a dummy? Pick Kelvin Gastelum in the year 2023, and that's what I'm going to do right now. I like his output, and I like his chin. Again, I've never seen Kelvin Gastelum get knocked out, which does mean something to me. I've seen him fight some devastating punchers in the past, and I do think Chris Curtis is a devastating puncher, so I will give him that credit. I think those opportunities to land the big shot will be there, but ever so slightly, I'm going to pick Kelvin Gastelum, and I don't feel great about it.
Including the Josh Saman win on The Ultimate Fighter, and then, of course, the fight against Uriah Hall, Kelvin Gastelum is 11-3 in three-round fights in the Zuffa banner. And again, he's 1-5 with a no contest in five-round fights. So for Gastelum, the big reset. For Chris Curtis, we'll see if that power punching works out. I love Chris Curtis in this matchup against Kelvin Gastelum with the counter-striking, but I like Kelvin Gastelum's pressure and his wrestling a little bit more. So both of us going with, yikes, Kelvin Gastelum in this fight. Let us know, please, and I know you will, down below in that comment section. If you're tuning in on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, rate and review the show. Matt, now we kick it into high gear over on the main card. Oh, yeah. Raul Rosas Jr. taking on Christian Rodriguez. Can't wait for it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. UFC 287 main card opener. We have the phenom. He's 18. It's Raul Rosas Jr. El Nino Problema. He's going to be taking on C-Rod, Christian Rodriguez. And Christian Rodriguez, if you follow Duke Rufus over on Facebook or Instagram, he's been talking about Christian Rodriguez for years. And not just him, but everybody that trains out of that gym. Paul Felder, Gerald Meerschaert, the Pettis brothers. They've always been pumping up Rodriguez. Oh, yeah. He came into the UFC on day's notice and up a weight class against Jonathan Pierce. Wasn't able to get the win. Had some competitive moments in that fight. But Jonathan Pierce, he's fighting at UFC 288 on the main card against Bryce Mitchell. He's kind of a good fighter as JSP. And for Rodriguez, he loses that fight, uproots it to fight ready to train with JSP to then go out there and beat Joshua Weems, who came in on really, really short notice. Rodriguez got a performance bonus last time out. And I've never seen somebody so unenthused about winning their UFC debut and getting a submission win in the first round. So great one for Rodriguez. He got taken down a couple of times by Weems, but in that one, we know how good Rodriguez jiu-jitsu is, but that's not even the A side of his game. His boxing is so good, mixing it head to body with the kicks. He cuts the cage. For a now 25-year-old, Rodriguez looks like a guy that grew up in an MMA gym when he was 14 years old, as he did. And I'll throw the Duke Rufus post up there. But Rodriguez is where Raul Rosas Jr. could be, even though the hype is with Rosas, and Rosas has two less fights as a pro. But when you look at all of this, Matt, Rosas Jr., his Dana White's Contender Series fight against Mondo Gutierrez, he wins that one by decision. Mondo was cool with pulling guillotine, and then Rosas was able to pull away. That was the first time that we got to see Rosas out of the first round into some deeper waters. And the best part of it for Rosas that almost lends credibility to that win, Mondo was, again, toughest fight that he ever had. But Mondo, I say tough, He's on Tough with Michael Chandler and Conor McGregor. So that lends credence to that one. Rosas' last time out took on the former CS man, Jay Perrin. A lot of bad blood in the interviews leading up to that one. Rosas able to get the fight down to the mat, get the finish pretty quickly. Looked really good in that one. But if you look at the Contender Series fight on the UFC's YouTube page, that fight has 4 million views. It was reposted on the ESPN MMA page. 1 million views of that fight against Manu Gutierrez. So 5 in total. Raul's definitely doing something right. The fight that he had against Jay Perrin into the hundreds of thousands of views of the fight and the interviews and everything leading up to it. He has a lot of hype behind him. But why not when you watch some of these performances with
the wrestling? He's really good. And that's the thing about Raul Rosas Jr. He has shown those capabilities once he is able to get the fight to where he does excel at. That definitely is the mat. I love the jiu-jitsu game. And the Perrin fight really did prove a lot to a lot of people, I think, because there were definitely reasonable question marks leading into his UFC debut. But after that, to see him kind of deal with, and I know this is a bit of an outdated term people don't use it, but to deal with like real man strength, you know, like he is only 18 years old. So the fact that he is fighting people who are not only older than him, but could be his dad. Like, it is kind of wild. So for Rojas, I was very surprised to see the success he was able to have on the mat after he got it there, because I was a little bit concerned about his physicality
if Jay Perrin's like 30, so he would have been
I understand, I'm just saying, like a guy who is kid? It's not a... You said Gerald Meerschaert's Chris Paul, Craig. You can let something go.
Slows the game down.
Chris Paul's one of the greatest of all time. Rosas Jr., though, at least those skills that he did have coming into the UFC, he's continued to work on it and been able to show at the UFC level, because that's what always concerns me. When you have a guy who is a great striker outside of the UFC, then they show up in their first fight, they're getting outstruck and going for panic takedowns. You hate to see that. But for Rosas, he has been very much the same fighter he was on the regional scene, and he's a big fighter for the weight class, too. I know I brought this up a lot in his debut, but Rosas Jr., I'll be interested to see if he sticks in the bantamweight division, or if just during time or after time he is forced to move up to featherweight, because he is very, very big.
Rosas Jr.'s had featherweight fights. Christian Rodriguez kind of bounced around between weight classes. He missed weight on Dana White's Contender Series when he did win. Weighed in at 138 in that episode. Didn't get the contract, but then you're kind of talking out of both sides of your mouth, because Jake Hadley missed weight on that episode, but they signed him. But they said Rodriguez needed more seasoning. Rodriguez's last time out made the weight at bantamweight, but Weems came in at 139.5. Now, Weems was in on 4 days' notice, and Rodriguez at 145. And his UFC debut was on 6 days' notice against Jonathan Pierce. So when you look at the matchup, Matt, I don't think it's crazy to say Christian Rodriguez is a much more complete mixed martial artist.
For sure.
His kicking game, his boxing, he mixes up to the body, to the head. He cuts the cage. He can definitely kind of pose striking issues for Rosas. And even if Rodriguez gets taken down, I've seen him pop back up to his feet. He's cool as a cucumber, and he doesn't leave himself defensively liable in a lot of those positions. Rosas, I've seen him kind of duck his head back because he is a bigger, taller guy in this weight class. He's added more kicks to his game. You saw that in his fight against Jay Perrin. I was trying to find recent interviews of Raul Rosas Jr., kind of getting ready for this one, and I found one that he did on the Evolve Your Game podcast back on February the 18th with his 20-year-old brother, who's 3-0 in MMA, Jesse Rosas, and he asks in the interview Mr. Abraham Ayala the most 18-year-old question I've ever heard a person ask somebody. Matt, are you ready for this?
I
prefaced it by saying you're going to laugh out loud, so if you don't, I didn't deliver. Raul says, and I quote, "I have a question for you, Abe. You have a wife and a kid. Because I see a lot of people that have a wife, you know, or like a girl, and like they get distracted from the game, you know. So how do you do it to stay on your
I mean, listen. I don't even know how to respond to that.
Is that the most 18-year-old question? How do you do it, Matt? With a wife and a kid. How do you function? Matt.
I almost said something terrible right there.
Raul Rosas Jr. has a good opportunity in this matchup against Christian Rodriguez.
I thought Raul Rosas Jr.'s brother was like, these hoes ain't loyal on a podcast.
No, he asked the buddy, not the brother. But when you look at it, I mean, Rosas Jr. is the favorite, and perennially he has been. You have a look at the fan vote on this one, and I bet everybody's sleeping on Christian Rodriguez. I'm going to say the over-under. I'm going to set it at 85% Rosas Jr.
I'll say under.
You're going to say under? It's over, so slightly. 1,848 total votes, 88% Rosas Jr., 66% by submission for the 12% that have Rodriguez, 58% by decision. And Rodriguez, for what it's worth, he's competed with Bellator, CFFC, LFA, Contender Series, UFC, brought up the right way, had an amateur career that was fairly extensive, as did Rosas Jr. One of them's on UFC 4,
One of them's rated a 4-star. So he's a 4-star grappling, 3.5
yeah,
star striking.
Everybody's a 4-star. 4-star
help.
To be fair.
Darren Till is rated a 4-star on that game.
Everybody. No. But if you played the game, everybody is rated a 4-star. Then John Volante and Sam Alvey, who are 3s.
What about like Chick Magnet Punk?
He's not even in it.
All right.
I think he's like a 2.5.
Chick
My
Magnet
point
Punk
is, unless you're not in the
Rodriguez.
UFC or not very good, everybody's a 4-star, so don't look into that at all.
What's the pick?
I have Jorge Rosas Jr. because I think he'll get the fight to the mat at some point. I think Rodriguez can offer him a lot of complications on the feet for as long as it stays there. I still think Rodriguez can keep this fight on the feet for 50 minutes, and for those reasons, I have Rosas Jr. I also come on this channel all the time and say, hey, the UFC might try to say, we're not like boxing, and Dana White's going to fix boxing, blah, 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 blah. There are a lot more like boxing entities than I think we do realize. And they want to push their A side, and the A side's Rosas Jr.
I'll go with Rosas Jr. in the matchup. I think he's just a little bit stickier with that grappling, and if he's going out there getting those takedowns, the singles, the doubles, he's forcing the action. The thing that I like out of Rosas Jr. that was a huge question mark coming on to Contender Series is, does he have a 3-round gas tank? You might go, well, at the time he's 17, of course he has a good gas tank. Think of yourself in high school. If you're just pounding hot dogs and drinking Pepsi, do you think you had really good gas? No. But Rosas Jr. is able to show in that matchup.
I don't think you were in the UFC when you were 18.
That he's able to get it done. So I did like that of Rosas Jr. And I think the wrestling can carry him to a win in this one. But if Rodriguez was able to get the win in it, it wouldn't necessarily surprise me as it would have Jay Perrin was able to do it. So Matt, both of us in the matchup going with El Nino Problema to get the win. And then we move the chains. The main event, Adesanya, he's going to look to challenge. That might come as a surprise. Taking on Mr. Alex Pereira. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
It's a possible fight of the night coming up this weekend. UFC 287 on the main card. Former top 15 stars. It's Trailblazer Kevin Holland taking on the Argentine Dagger Santiago Ponzinibbio. And when you look at this matchup, Matt, it feels like a must-win fight for both of these guys, even though Ponzinibbio is coming off a performance bonus winning knockout in the third round over the great white Alex Morono. For Holland, he's dropped his last two to Stephen Wonderboy Thompson and Khamzat Chimaev. And in that Chimaev fight, UFC 279, he was originally due Daniel Rodriguez at 170, Chimaev at the weigh-in complications. So Holland fights Chimaev in the co-main event. Diaz ends up in the main event.
Do you know a fight I didn't watch once in preparation for this, though? Chimaev versus Kevin Holland. Because I'm here to tell you right now, you learned nothing about him fighting Santiago Ponzinibbio from that fight.
I mean, you look at it, so Holland ends up losing really quickly, contemplates retirement, kind of talks it out in the public eye, and then he draws a favorable matchup his last time out against Stephen Wonderboy Thompson, a striker, a guy that's not going to take you down, or so everybody thought. And in that one, Matt, and I mean, that was That was the only full card video we've done start to bottom live. I'm never doing that again. We did it one time, whole thing live. It's never going to happen.
You guys don't realize how hard talking for 3 hours straight really is. It is unbearable.
But if you look at that one, Matt, I mean, what an odd fight it really was when it went back to the rewatch.
I gotta say this, though, too. What an odd fight Ponzinibbio versus Morono was in the rewatch, too, because I gotta be honest, Ponzinibbio losing 2 rounds to Alex Morono was a hard image to get out of my mind. And I know he ends up getting the win and he looks really good by the end of it. But this is my thing, though, and I think you'll agree with me. Just hear me out before you do anything.
I'm just fishing.
Alex Morono is right here to be hit. You don't gotta look for him because he's right there. Showtime Pettis teed off on him before he left and he was at 170 pounds. Kevin Holland is not nearly as easy to hit as Alex Morono was, so I just worry about Ponzinibbio. And what is he going to be able to do on some of the in-betweens if he's not just landing a lot of big power shots?
And I'll reel that big fish in, because for Ponzinibbio, he was originally due Robbie Lawler a southpaw in that matchup.
But he fights a lot like Morono.
On 4 days' notice, he ends up with Alex Morono, an orthodox fighter. Morono looked great in the first 2 rounds. Like, I had Morono, he dropped him early. He was able to rock him twice and wobble him. In the third round, Morono was looking good. And then Ponzinibbio was able to land that right hand. It froze Alex Morono's face. Then he landed another and it
dropped
him.
It's one of those situations where sometimes you can look at a win and it overshadows some of the negatives that happened during the fight. Sometimes you can look at a loss and that overshadows some of the positives. For Ponzinibbio, you're going to look at that green W on Tapology and feel a lot of confidence based on that last matchup. Sorry, but I don't necessarily feel that way is all I want to say.
Well, I mean, Bruce Buffer. I mean, while that fight was going on at the start, he was shooting his breath into Ponzinibbio's face. They were
aggressive.
Right here. It was really weird, so throw the picture up there for that one. But when you do look at it for Kevin Holland, the reason why I say that fight against Wonderboy was weird, first round's competitive,
Second round's competitive. Third and fourth round were not competitive at all. It was all Wonder Boy. And Holland, I mean, he was kind of touching on the fact that he broke his hand. At the end of the fourth round, you kind of hear, and I threw it in my notes because I found it weird. You heard somebody say, stop the fight, but you couldn't see the face. And then you saw Holland go, take these off, please. And he was talking about his gloves, and then he was holding his right hand. And I'll throw the tweet up there from Mark Raimondi. Like, Kevin Holland broke multiple bones in his hand, and they were displaced. And that was his right hand. So what's his laser weapon that he utilizes the best in all of these fights? It is his right hand. And that fight was back in December. So you have to wonder how Holland has kind of recouped and recovered after breaking, you know, that many bones in his hand and that being his best weapon. Now taking on a guy like Ponzinibbio, who, for Ponzinibbio, it was almost like he was really, really thinking the game in a lot of those early fights on his way up. And I know he had that long layoff, 2018 to 2021.
I thought he was going to be an Usman before he got laid off. I've said this many times.
And Ponzinibbio, he came back. He got performance of the nighted against Li Jingliang, got knocked out in that one. But then he's had fight of the nights. He's had, you know, the performance bonuses last time out. The split decision losses, one against Jeff Neal and one against Michelle Pereira. The Pereira fight was a fight of the night.
Both very close.
Ponzinibbio's been putting on really fun performances, but why is that? Because the dance partner's been there to counter him. And
he gets hit.
He's been throwing kind of like off balance and then mixing combinations off balance to try and land that right hand power shot.
What Ponzinibbio was really good at is he'll throw a straight right into a left hook and then just try to set up the right hook after that initial left hook. Or I guess after the subsequent left hook is what I meant to say. But for Ponzinibbio, if he's not able to get into that rhythm, there isn't a lot outside of it. Now, I'm a big Pons. Again, I thought he was going to beat Usman when they fought all the way back in Chile before Damian Maia ended up getting into that main event. I just think really highly of Ponzinibbio's skill set. My point is, I agree with everything you said about Kevin Holland and his hand health. But if at the end of a prediction video it comes down to, I think one guy has a lot of the answers to the other guys, but I'm a little bit worried about his health, I still have to pick the guy who I think has a lot of the counters for Ponzinibbio's skill set.
And I mean, Kevin Holland on his Instagram when he was announcing this fight, he's calling for the submission win over Santiago Ponzinibbio.
Called that a lot in the Tim Means fight.
I wonder why he said that. I just worry about that hand. And then when I do look at this matchup overall, Holland, he has that big reach advantage. He has the slight height advantage. If he can keep behind the jab, mix in the 1-2, and throw in a few of his kicks, I mean, Kevin Holland could definitely get a win. But Ponzinibbio, if he's able to crash the distance, Wonderboy was able to get that late kind of takedown off of Holland. And he hits Holland with the right hand. Holland panics into a takedown attempt. And that kind of was the beginning of the end at the end of that fourth round when you had Wonderboy just kind of pouring on the offense in the matchup. I don't know if I've ever seen somebody where one side of their head stayed in braids and the other side puffed up like a balloon.
Jimmy Butler when he pulled them out like 2 games ago.
Okay, Matt, I don't think people are watching regular season Miami Heat games, but this is going to take place.
That's why I'm here, Craig, for the
Miami Dade Arena. Matt, when you look at it, Holland is favored in the matchup. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Eager to see these because I don't know where to set the line. I'm going to say over-under on the Tapology votes, 72.5% Holland.
Anything under 80%, I was going to say Holland.
Oh. And it's over 80%. So you have 1,835 total votes, 82% Holland, 59% by knockout for the 18% that are Ponzinibbio, 59% by decision. Matt, I have the Trailblazer Kevin Holland. Do you?
I do. I have a pretty good idea as to Ponzinibbio's skill set, I'd like to think. He throws a lot of heavy leg kicks. He throws a lot of set combinations. But again, if he's not throwing those set combinations, he's not a guy who's going to really wow you with his output. That's been the really big thing that holds him back from fighting some of those elite guys in the division. If he did have sort of that top tier output, again, Max Holloway's not a great example. Even a Neil Magny, for instance, I know he beat Neil Magny, but that's just because he has good leg kicks and a lot of power, so that tends to beat Neil Magny. So I think Ponzinibbio can make this an interesting fight, but I do have Kevin Holland in.
And I have Kevin Holland just based on the volume, I mean, but you do look at the volume numbers for Ponzinibbio. 5.02 to 4.65 is the comeback. Significant strikes landed per minute to absorb. If you look at it for Holland, 4.06 to 2.96. And I don't know if Ponzinibbio is going to have that game plan out of ATT to go for a lot of takedowns, but he could very well have success in a matchup against Holland with that. So, Matt, both of us going with the Trailblazer, Kevin Holland, to get back in the win column. But I'm really eager to hear from some of those commenters down below on this matchup. We have some big-time fights on this card, including Rob Font and Adrian Yanez. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Bantamweight just might be the premier division in all of MMA, and with the last two of the three UFC cards that we've had main evented by Bantamweights, we have a premier matchup in this division between Rob Font taking on Adrian Yanez. And Matt, we and everybody else have been mispronouncing Adrian's last name since he's been around, since when he was with the LFA. Now that he's into the UFC, he clarified it on his Twitter not that long ago. It's not Yanez, it's Yanez. And for Adrian Yanez at a Metro Boomin Metro Fight Club, this is a guy that's really been able to turn it on. Like, if you look at it, Yanez hasn't lost a fight since 2018. He's on a giant win streak. He's already 5-0 in the UFC. And he's perfect in those five fights at adding extra money to his bank account. Four performance bonuses, a fight of the night against Davy Grant a couple of matchups ago. And now all of a sudden, Adrian's going, and I know we don't like to go by this, but I think this is a pretty good metric. He's going from fighting the number 105
bantamweight. You just said the rankings were BS.
The Tapology rankings. Okay, you go from fighting the 105th ranked bantamweight, Tony Kelly, to fighting the 11th ranked bantamweight Rob Font. It's a giant step up in competition from Adrian going from fighting unranked competition to now top ranked competition in a guy like Rob Font, who for his own right has main evented three shows in a row, a win over Cody Garbrandt and a couple of losses to Jose Aldo and Marlon Vera. And when we talk about these Rob Font fights, win, lose, or draw, Rob Font, especially out of those last two fights,
exciting,
overwhelming volume numbers, but his last two times out, it was the power of Aldo and the power of Vera that were able to kind of shift the tide in the minds of the judges and win the fights for Aldo and for Vera.
But yeah, this is the wild thing about MMA judging. Like, if people
it's awful.
No, it's not. Like, everybody's awful at it, though, because the criteria is not really clear enough for people to have a great example.
It's written in stone.
I know it's written in stone, but nobody follows the exact example, so it doesn't matter, and that's why I don't get fired up about MMA decisions, because they're all terrible, and there's a lot of close ones and a ton of gray areas. So, for Rob Font, he does have a lot of that output, but there has been a lack of that necessarily huge power shot behind a lot of the jab and the output of a guy like Rob Font, and I'll be interested to see what he does in this matchup against Yanez, because Adrian's a guy who does eat a decent amount of damage. He's not eating massive fight-ending shots by any means, but if you throw a lot of volume, he's not a guy who's going to move his head a ton. He does have good parrying abilities with his hands. He'll move your hands away and counter with his own, but if you do implement kicks, which again, Rob Font, not massive in that area, but something he could do, or if you can just outrange him, and again, that's a very difficult thing to do if you don't have kicks of your own, because a lot of these examples I bring up where Yanez has had difficulty at range, it's not because he's fighting primary boxers. It's because guys who have kicks have then been able to incorporate some of their punches afterwards. So I think this matchup will be interesting for two major points. How will Yanez deal with the volume of a guy like Rob Font? But also, we've seen Font get hurt by power shots as of late that didn't necessarily see him get hurt by earlier on in his career. And I know it's Jose Aldo, I know it's Marlon Vera, those are very heavy-handed fighters. But it is fair to say that Font earlier in his career would eat like sledgehammers and just walk through them. I will be interested to see if Yanez can get on the inside and land his own power shots. How will Rob Font be affected by it? Because I know he didn't get knocked out by Aldo or Vera, but he got hurt more times than I could count both those fights.
Yeah, and he was on skates in the fight against Jose Aldo. There were two credited knockdowns for Aldo, but the total strikes, significant strikes, 149 to 86 for Font, and then in the fight against Marlon Vera, 271 to 159, but it was a left hook, it was then a knee, it was then a head kick for Vera that were able to knock down Rob Font through round 2, 3, and round 4. So for Font, he's got to get back to a three-round atmosphere. He's been off for quite some time since that fight against Marlon Vera way back last year, almost a full year ago.
And I think that's good for him.
It definitely is. And 35 for Rob Font is a little tricky, but you look at it for Font in the UFC, 9-5 through the run. His strike differential number overall, 6.38 to 3.95. So it is tricky that way. Obviously for Yanez, the biggest step up that he's had so far in his career, already 19 pro fights. We used to compare him to Jorge Masvidal that's in the co-main event coming up this weekend because he'll mix in the leg kicks into his combination. He does look like him. But if you look at the kicks that he was able to go out there and throw, 17 of his 64 significant strikes against Randy Costa, chopping the wood, as Daniel Cormier would say. And we know it in the first round, Costa was able to land from the outside.
Just way too hot.
And then Yanez figured it out in the second round. But the wins in the UFC, Victor Rodriguez, he dropped Gustavo Lopez with a counter shot in the second round, finished him with another counter in the third. Randy Costa, Davy Grant, Tony Kelly. not a lot of guys that are still in the UFC, but the Davy Grant fight was a
I thought he looked good against Grant, though, to be fair.
It was a fight of the night. Judge Tony Weeks scored at 30-27 Grant. The other two had at 29-28.
But Grant's a good fighter. Like, even if you have a close fight with him, you're proving something to a lot of people.
For Yanez, even the win that Yanez had over Kyle Estrada, the main event of LFA 78, was a nice back and forth. Fights outside of the UFC, some of the losses, Miles Johns, Domingo Plarte, and Levi Mowles. Good fighters in their own right. But yeah, Yanez has to be able to figure out the jab, the 1-2, the mix and the uppercut of a guy like Rob Font. Rob Font will kind of dip level changes to make you think. Yanez will mix in those hooks to the body, to the head. And the thing that Yanez does well, once he's able to figure out cutting off the cage in a fight, he can kind of just mix it in from there. First round against Gustavo.
Like Allison Chain sang about, you become the man in the box.
Adrian Yanez has to get through a first round to win the second and the third, in my opinion, after watching his fights, because even Gustavo Lopez, round the outside. The fight against Randy Costa was pushing the pace on the outside. You go down through it. Once Yanez figures it out, he boxes you in with the lead hook, and then he starts doing his work. That's when you're in trouble. The fight that I went back to and watched, Matt, for this one, can you guess which one for Rob Font?
I watched the Davy Grant, the Randy Costa one, like, multiple times, so I'm assuming one of those two.
No, the fight for Rob Font. Rob Font won the place.
Oh, sorry. Tiny Vitor. But it was too long ago, so don't take it into consideration.
Main event was Ally Quinta taking on Kevin Lee for the second time. Rob Font fought the second-ranked flyweight, moving up to 135. The champ over with Bellator, Sergio Pettis. Rob Font tucking the chin, working in the level changes, working in the jab and the right hand, setting things up with the uppercut. He dominated all of the action of that fight, all three judges.
Sergio didn't look good, though. But Sergio stayed on the outside, didn't go for any takedowns, wasn't that dedicated to his own combinations.
Yanez can struggle with those things on the outside.
But the difference is, Yanez is a guy who's going to try to get on the inside to land his own power shots. Sergio Pettis is not a one-punch knockout guy. Like, I know he knocked out Horiguchi with a spinning back fist. He lost every second of that fight leading up to that, though. I still know Pettis needs the kicks to have success, even though he's not Anthony. He still needs to mix that in and have his own takedowns. I don't think Yanez needs any kind of grappling to be able to win this fight. I really do just worry about the overall durability of a guy like Rob Font, because I've seen him eat a lot of big shots in the feet at this point. And it's not just him getting rocked or getting wobbled or getting knocked down. His face is starting to show meaningful damage as he does get hit in some of these fights. And I know they are 25-minute atmospheres, they're 5-round fights, but those are things that does concern me as you start to age in a division.
Well, a giant step up for Yanez. He is the favorite in the matchup for Rob Font. Gets to come back down 2-3-round atmosphere, and his last 3-round fight, Marlon Moraes, where Marlon decided he was a wrestler. He's lost 6 fights in a row. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprises us there to you. I'm going to say over under 72.5% for Metro Boomin, Metro Fight Club's Adrian Yanez.
I think they'll be under.
Think they're going to be under? Oh, you looked at these before.
I did not get some wrong.
18. You got one wrong. 1,833 total votes. 71% Yanez. 41% by decision. 51% by knockout for the 29% that have Rob Font. 81% by decision. Can Adrian Yanez knock out Rob Font like the fans say that he can?
I feel like I came into this video really thinking Rob Font was going to win, if I'm being honest. I really thought his output would kind of stifle the movement of a guy like Yanez, because what I do like out of Rob Font is he does remind me a lot, and I bring this up a lot, is when Aljamain Sterling fought Piotr Jan. Piotr Jan's a great striker, but if you throw a lot at him, he is kind of stuck in a defensive shell. He doesn't really have the opportunities to throw on his own, and I am curious to see if Yanez is going to find himself in some of those positions, focusing a lot more on his defense than his offense. The difference is, Yanez has way more power than Cody Garbrandt at this stage of his career, I would say, at bantamweight, and Font, I just worry about him eating some of those big shots. I think Rob can win this fight by decision. I wouldn't be surprised whatsoever, but he's going to have to eat some damaging shots to get there. And at 35 years old, I'm a little bit concerned. So ever so slightly, I'm going with Yanez. But no, the reason I said under 72% is I think Rob Font has a phenomenal chance to win this fight.
Yeah, and that's why I have him to win it.
His level of competition has been ridiculous in the UFC, and that's the main thing.
Yeah, Yanez, I've loved the rise. I picked him in all of these fights. I absolutely love it. But for Rob Font, a 3-round fight definitely helps him. The time away definitely helps him. The footwork's still there. When's Rob Font getting hit in these? It's on the half beat, and it's when he's planting his feet and sticking around for that receipt. So if Yanez is able to hit him on those, that's the very best. But for Font, he doesn't have one-round cardio like some of these other guys have struggled with. And some of these other guys have also struggled with, my back's up against the fence, now where do I go? There's nowhere.
To be fair, though, Font does struggle with that. He struggled with that against Vera. He struggled, like, that's the position Font doesn't excel at, I'd say.
For me, going with Rob Font, we're split on the pick. Let us know down below in the comment section. Are you going with Yanez in this giant meteoric win streak, or will Rob Font find the win column once more? Matt, we move forward. I mean, listen, you have a giant fight coming up next that you are not going to want to miss, so keep it locked in with Fightin' Apex, as we always say. Let's get into it. South Florida's premier gyms going at it. Coming up this weekend to the co-main event, it is Killcliff FC versus American Top Team. Two former welterweight title challengers going at it for a scrap. It is Gilbert Durinho Burns taking on Gamebred Jorge Masvidal. Matt, people might know Gamebred from Icon FC. They might know him from Gamebred Boxing. I mean, Jorge Masvidal. Getting it done outside.
They probably
of the
know him for knocking out Ben Askren, to be fair.
They probably know him for knocking out Ben Askren. Even in his promo for Gamebred Boxing, he jumped in off camera with a knee and then promoted the boxing. But for Masvidal, looking for his first win in a meaningful amount of time. He lost both times against Kamaru Usman. Fair. He ended up his last time out against Colby Covington, getting a fight of the night. One judge scored a round for him. The other two scored at 50-45 and 50-44. So it wasn't necessarily all that competitive. But it's not necessarily just about that fight. Because a few weeks later, the steakhouse incident, and we haven't seen Jorge Masvidal or Colby Covington compete in the octagon. Now, Masvidal went on the JRE MMA show, and he said, and I quote, Joe Rogan says, what happened illegally? And Jorge says, allegedly a lot of things happened, bro. I don't know. So Jorge Masvidal playing it cool as ice. But for Masvidal, again, the last win that he has was against Nate Diaz.
This is how I look at this fight. And again, I've been one-sided on a couple of these, but I'm just going to say what I feel. If I didn't see Gilbert Burns get knocked out by Dan Hooker at 155 pounds, there would be no question in my mind he wins this fight. I'm just being honest. Is he a better pure wrestler than Jorge Masvidal? Without a doubt. Gilbert Burns not only has great one-touch, one-kill jiu-jitsu, he is a very physically dominant wrestler with that. I talked about the Tyron Woodley fight before we even started filming, but that fight really cemented in my mind, okay, this guy can wrestle at 170 pounds, because I know you might laugh at Tyron Woodley at this stage of his career, but for the longest time, not only was he known as the welterweight champion, he had second to none takedown defense. Was impossible to take down. And I know Usman was able to get him down a couple of times in their matchup, but the fact that Burns was not only able to get him down but control him was really telling in that matchup, because I do think it speaks to how talented of a grappler a guy like Gilbert Burns is. And in a matchup like this, I know people are going to want to say, oh, but the flying knee. And hey, I know you bring up the scorecards against Covington, but Masvidal did land the most damaging shot of that fight, to be fair. He landed a check right hook that dropped Colby Covington. I know Covington had a pretty funny quote after the fight about it, but still, Masvidal is very dangerous from any moment in the fight because he has great cardio, great punching power, and great hand speed. The problem is, and this is why, like, Joe Rogan came out and said, oh, Jorge Masvidal's, like, better than GSP, because if he fought GSP's time period, he's so much better. That's insane. Jorge Masvidal and George St. Pierre are like the same age right now. The difference is George St. Pierre's, I'm just going to say it, the greatest fighter of all time. And Jorge Masvidal's had like a 500 record in the UFC for a minute now. So this isn't me diminishing Jorge Masvidal. I just think some of those quotes have been a little insane as of late. I think he has a great chance to win this fight because, again, Burns is a guy who has good striking, and that's been the part of his game he's continued to improve upon, but he leaves big openings when he does throw some of those strikes. He has a big looping left hook, same thing with the right hook, and I could see a world where Masvidal is able to counter off of those, but my concern is Masvidal's going to have to make a lot of quick decisions very fast because he's going to be pressured a lot by Burns.
Quick decisions very fast, so you don't
he's
say. He's
going to make quick decisions on the back foot against a guy like Gilbert Burns, and for those reasons, I think it's going to be really interesting to see how Masvidal fights this fight, because being on your back foot against Gilbert Burns is a difficult way to win a mixed martial arts
and
contest.
Remember how Masvidal looked against Donald Cerrone in that fight that they had? Then he dropped a couple in a row, Damian Maia and Stephen Wonderboy Thompson. So what does he do? That's when he reinvents himself, brother. It is the Exaltalan Estados Unidos. He ends
like Dark Kermit
on that show, and Jorge Masvidal comes back, strings off three giant wins, and then we're off to the races to the title fights. And you can't minimize those fights. And the best part...
It was such a fun run, exactly.
The best part for Masvidal out of all of that, if he beats Gilbert Burns, you might not like it,
but he and Leon Edwards shared some words. Now, Leon shared words, and then with his hands down, Masvidal kind of went after it. But for Masvidal, threw the three-piece in the soda, as he described it with Brett Okamoto after that. And now we're into a situation where Masvidal definitely really needs a win after three losses. But as I mentioned earlier, he set himself up for retirement with Game Bread Boxing, with Icon FC. He has a lot of things going on in the personal life, the line of mezcal. There's so many things going on in the life for him. Masvidal, a guy who headlined Bellator number one. John Anik used to be a Bellator commentator. Exactly. What was Jorge Masvidal's record at Bellator 1? 16-3. That's Adrian Yanez's record right
now.
He's
been around, guys.
Masvidal's been around the block a time or two. For Gilbert Burns, the same thing can be said. And for both of these guys, lightweight experience before until lightweight became a problem. And then they moved up to welterweight. Burns debuted way back when, against Andreas Stahl back in 2014. And then he was able to get it moving. Burns in the UFC, a tidy 14-5 record. For Masvidal, 12-9. But overall, you look at the matchup, Matt, people might forget that Gilbert Burns had a 2021 Fight of the Year contender against, Khamzat Chimaev at the start of the year.
He got dropped like six times in that fight, though.
No, this is my point. Do people remember Gilbert Burns' fight back in January? Like, he just fought. That's the craziest part about this. He fought against Neil Magny, main card of a pay-per-view, finished him in the first round. And then, other than having a full head of hair, there's not much to talk about. First 2.5 minutes of that round, nothing happens. There's a body kick from Gilbert Burns. Both guys, Neil Magny goes, ha, ha, and throws some jabs that hit the air. And then Burns takes the action to the mat, controls from side control to guard to side control, and then did exactly what RDA did, gets him in a head and arm triangle, and that's the end of the matchup.
I think we're going to see a very similar performance. This is the thing. Masvidal has a great chance to win this fight if it's on the feet. Again, he has great power, great hand speed. And that's the thing that I do think gets lost. His hand speed is the X factor. It's not the power. He does have great power. But the way that he can mix in his combinations use his hand speed.
What do we
really
always talk about the Jorge Masvidal combination, the switch with his kick?
Well, it's not even just like any combination he throws with his boxing. I know that can accentuate it because of the Darren Till performance. But you can't just let that knockout cloud it. Like, he has great combinations on the outside, on the inside. He can get dirty with his boxing. He can be kind of pretty on the outside and work his jab. That's what I like about Masvidal. But I do worry about what he's going to do if he is on the bat or on his back against a guy like Burns. Because Burns offers a very unique threat compared to a guy like Usman or Covington. Covington and Usman are great wrestlers. But once they get you down, yes, they can get submissions. But a lot of those submissions are going to be opened up based on your own exhaustion. Gilbert Burns is going to find submissions, though, if you're on the mat and you make a mistake. And I think that's one area of Masvidal's game that he's really going to have to focus on in this matchup. And that's the one thing. Like, the odds are very one-sided, so I'm a little surprised to see this matchup.
Boo Earns is the favorite in the matchup. We have a look at the YouTube community tab. We threw it out there to you on the YouTube channel. If you're not subscribed and you're not checking this stuff out, you should. And Matt, I mean, we're talking about the fact that there's about 1,000 votes on this poll as I reload it. 78% going with Gilbert Burns to get the win. Mark is saying, I think Jorge's takedown defense will make this closer than expected. Burns by split decision on account of bad judges.
Wow, I like it.
Mark gets it. The judges are bad. Adam Barron, Florida boy Jorge by either southpaw jab, lead uppercut, right straight from orthodox, or decision. Y'all must have forgot performance. One of the OGs of the sport 20 years in. What other finishes did you get?
Direct, though. I like it.
Like, one, two, three, four, five different ways to win. Chandler Witt, I feel like Burns by murder is the expected result, but I have a bad feeling Masvidal sleeps him and rolls the hype straight to a title shot against Leon. And I'll go with one more in...
Jacob.
Twizzy Rich saying, Jorge KO, y'all gonna see. Matt, what we gonna see?
I don't think we will. Again, I bring up the Dan Hooker performance because that's one that does linger in the back of my mind as somebody who Gilbert Burns is probably a little bit more skilled in if you just look at the over-encompassing amount of the mixed martial arts. But Dan Hooker was able to just be really accurate on the feet. And I don't think Burns isn't durable. I don't think that's the case. Like, he has crazy drive, he has wild heart. But we have seen him get hurt on the feet numerous occasions. So, again, I think that window is open for Masvidal. But due to the totality of Burns' skill set, I have Gilbert Burns.
He's got good heart. He's got a lot of drive.
But it's like, that's Lee McBurns. He gets dropped, but he never loses because it's like, oh, I can't win this fight. Like, Chimaev had him dead to rights on numerous times in that matchup. Burns dug so effing deep, it was ridiculous to make that fight competitive.
To me, it's a grappling differential between the two guys. And I mean, for Jorge Masvidal, is he a good grappler? Sure, yes. He is. I mean, he hasn't gotten to this point by being a subpar grappler and didn't get finished by Usman in the first fight, didn't get finished by Covington.
Or Maya.
Didn't get finished by Damian Maya and was able to make it somewhat competitive. But, yeah, I mean, against the Covington fight, the lasting image is that straight shot, Masvidal going down. So for me, I do like Gilbert Burns in the matchup. But this is the big thing for me, for Burns' last time out, heavy feeling out process at distance against Neil Magny. If he does the same thing against Jorge Masvidal, the numbers could start to pour in for game bread if Burns does so desire to let it go that way until he shoots for a takedown. So really eager to see what we get out of these two guys at welterweight in the matchup. The main event, the fourth meeting, the second in a cage, the second for the title. Alex Pereira looking to make the first title defense. 6 pay-per-views. He won that big time shiny belt. He's taking on Israel Adesanya. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Nate Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, the fourth installment and the second consecutive in the UFC's octagon. Coming up in the main event of UFC 287, Alex Pereira taking on Israel Adesanya, the last style bender. As always, one half your host to do, Craig Allen, Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, respective socials, Matt Allen FNP. And it's a big time matchup because of not just the two fights that they had in the ring over with kickboxing with Glory, but if you consider it the last time out, Israel Adesanya, Alex Pereira, UFC 281, the main event. Adesanya, he was well on his way to winning. He had already won 3 of the 4 rounds that had taken place, the second round going to Pereira. But man, if you watch Pereira in that 5th and final round, cutting the cage, throwing his hooks, and every single time he crowded space, went to the body, up to the head, he really got a big reaction out of Israel Adesanya. So looking to make it 2 straight there for Pereira. It would be his 8th straight win because he dropped his pro debut by submission. He is obviously the noted one of the greatest kickboxers of all time. The middleweight, light heavyweight champ over there, simultaneous with Glory at the point in time. But for Pereira, inside of the UFC's octagon, the wins, by now you know them. Mihailidis, Bruno Silva, Sean Strickland, and Adesanya. For Adesanya, comes in against now PFL champ Rob Wilkinson, and he was off to the races. The only losses inside of an MMA cage for Adesanya, one up a weight class to Jan Blachowicz, where he struggled against some of the wrestling and the striking of the bigger man, and his last time out against Mr. Alex Pereira. And for Pereira, for his troubles, Matt, on our year-end award show, he was like the co-champion of the year. We had Volkanovski and Pereira for what he was able to do. But I know you put a lot of stock into, as you should, that last fight that Pereira had against Adesanya.
This is the thing. This fight, to me, exists inside of a bubble outside of the middleweight division. I know that's a weird thing to say, but I'm going to sit here right now and tell you guys, if Alex Pereira was fighting Robert Whittaker this weekend, you know who I would have picked in that fight? Robert Whittaker, and not even thought twice about it, if I'm being honest. Like, I know how MMA math works. I know you guys would say, oh, but Izzy beat Rob, and Pereira's beat Izzy, so of course he'd win that matchup. But no, Pereira to me is really just Israel Adesanya's, like, own opponent in life and nothing else. Because, and I know that's a wild thing to say, but Pereira, I don't think, is going to have a lot of competitive matchups with guys in the top 15. Now, I say that not to say he's not going to beat guys in the top 15, but when I say they won't be competitive, do I sit here and look at the top division and think, oh, there's a lot of close fights by the end of the 5th round that Pereira would be involved in? No. Either he knocks everybody out in the first 6 minutes of the fight, or their grappling would probably get to him as the fight goes on. So to me, this is a very interesting fight, but it is difficult to look at Alex Pereira, to me at least, and think, oh, how is he going to match up against everybody else? Because he is such a primary kickboxer, and I know he has proven that he is more than just that in his UFC tenure, but I really do have a hard time thinking he's going to go out there and out-grapple guys in the top 15. Could he hold his own? Can he do well defensively? Yes, he can definitely do that. But when he starts grappling with guys like Roman Dolidze, Marvin Vettori, I don't think he can really hold his own in some of those positions. But what I will say is, and I know what you were kind of leading to, what I took so much from their last fight was, there's 2 things in their last fight that I think you have to really watch.
And the fact that both guys get takedowns.
The fact that both guys get takedowns, and nobody thought that was going to happen. But Izzy hurts Pereira at the end of the first round with a straight right after Alex is moving forward trying to pressure him. That is what Adesanya has to do throughout this fight if he wants to win, because I do think Pereira kind of unlocked something at the end of that fight. He figured out, because he had Izzy in this position a lot throughout the matchup. It was, hey, I have Izzy behind those two black lines. Not that he's stuck on the fence because he does such a great job at moving, but I have his back up against the fence and I have limited his movement. If you're Pereira and you're as good of a striker as he is, in your mind, do you not just think, why don't I unload every time I see him in this spot? Well, I know it's easier said than done because the counter's coming back, but Alex Pereira is one of the best kickboxers in the world. Not only does he have the technique, he has the power that basically nobody can match in the middleweight division. So unless Izzy either A, uses the wrestling shoes, and we have seen that a lot in his training footage leading up to this fight, I will say, I've seen a lot of Izzy using his grappling and his wrestling, but I gotta say this, I hate it when primary strikers start using the thing that they're not primarily good at in fights, because it's almost like an admittance of, hey, you're better than me at the thing that I'm great at. So I think Izzy could use his wrestling, but do I love the fact that Izzy might win a title fight with 25 minutes of wrestling? No, not at all.
No, and I'm sure a little bit of that kind of builds into of, oh, now he's a wrestler, but he utilizes striking as it is. But when you look back at that fight, the first meeting between these two guys, and I'll throw up our reaction to Pereira's win in that matchup.
Good little shovel hook there.
Oh!
Great left hook. Adesanya up against the cage.
Oh, he's got him hurt!
He's hurt up against the cage. Adesanya might be out on his feet. He's hurt bad.
Pereira's landing! New middleweight champ, Alex Pereira!
Wow!
Oh my goodness!
He knocked out Israel Adesanya with seconds left in a fight that he was losing.
We talk about it as, with the channel, one of our favorite strikes, the left hook to the body, and Pereira was able to close distance with that. He was able to kind of shut things down. But the total strike numbers for Pereira are really telling. 42 shots to the head, 27 to the body, and 22 to the leg. And I touched on it earlier on in this card. You know, you look at Ignacio Bahamondes, a guy that has a karate background into MMA, and he doesn't necessarily fight like a wild, flashy karate striker like Karate Combat that just happened last night. But when you look at it for guys like Bahamondes, guys like Pereira, no big wind up and load on those leg kicks. Really easy. Snappy. They hurt their opponents. And then there's no big reset. Pereira's one of those guys, that left hook that digs to the body to then open up the hooks to the head. He was able to get Adesanya out with those movements.
And to your point, same side attacks he'll double up on. That's a great point. He'll go left to the body, left to the head when you expect the right to follow.
Now, I did see some people saying, okay, well, at this point right now, Pereira's already 2-0 in kickboxing. He's already 1-0 in MMA. This isn't a rivalry, because I consider it a rivalry matchup. But when you look at it, the first fight between these two guys, majority of people thought that Adesanya won the kickboxing match in China when his nickname was, and I quote, the Black Dragon. He cut a big pro-China piece.
If I beat you three times in the NBA Finals, you can't see the games were close
leading
up to there.
This is the trouble. Adesanya, in my mind, won that first fight, won the third round. The first two rounds were really close. The next fight against Pereira, standing eight count. Standing eight count early on in that matchup, and then as it went on, Pereira was able to stop, just clinching to try and save his brain some time, and then he got back into it, lands a hook, drops him dead, runs around the square, and then ends up just kind of shouting it at Adesanya, and then the last time out, it's another knockout win. So that's two knockouts in a row. Heading into a fourth matchup, it's hard to overlook those wins at this point now. So for Adesanya, I mean, he was building the lineage, as we saw a guy like Kamaru Usman recently, where both guys, they're unstoppable in their respective weight classes. They're going on to this kind of greatness category where GSP is getting rivaled at welterweight and Anderson Silva is getting rivaled because obviously Adesanya was able to beat him, no less, but kind of equal.
He was 43 when he beat him.
What Adesanya or what Silva was able to do. But then I went back and I thought, okay, because of what we saw Leon Edwards do against Usman recently, how often are champions able to kind of, or ex-champions, come right back, immediate rematch, and then win the
Not
fight?
Not often.
And son of a gosh darn gun, the UFC.com and Zach Placeb wrote an article 3 days ago titled "The History of Former Champions Getting Immediate Rematches." Belfort beat Couture. Couture then beat Belfort. Edgar beat Penn.
Are they really going through all these?
Edgar beat Penn. Henderson beat Edgar. Henderson beat Edgar. Weidman beat Silva twice. Max Holloway beat Aldo twice.
Dustin Poirier beat Max Holloway twice. I know the first one wasn't for a belt,
but
still.
These are just title fights. Naomi Yunus beat Joanna twice. Dillashaw beat Garbrandt twice. Volkanovski beat Holloway twice. Title. Cormier beat Miocic. Well, no. It was Cormier beat Miocic the first time, then Miocic won twice. Moreno, Figueiredo, the first one was a draw, the next one Moreno won, the next one was a Figueiredo win. Pena wins, and then Nunes wins, so that's one. And then Edwards, Usman. So out of all of the immediate title rematches, Randy Couture beating Vitor Belfort, that was their third fight, but the second one for the title, Couture, and then Moreno and Nunes. Those are the only ones in UFC history where it was back for the title and the fighter was able to get the win. It's not something that happens very often, and Israel Adesanya is looking to buck that trend and get it done. He is favored slightly in this matchup, but this is one where you throw it out to the YouTube community tab, Matt, and what is the percentage on this one?
Alex Pereira is a big favorite. He has a 65% of the vote right now, as Israel Adesanya only has 35%, which is a little bit surprising, A, based on where the votes were, and based on where the odds are off of 1,200 votes.
1,200 total votes on our YouTube community tab. Out of the comments, Izzy better come out in a singlet, says Chandler Witt. Russ Gaudette, I think Izzy's going to mimic Sandhagen last week and outperform Alex.
That's a decent call, to be honest.
Which, yeah, I mean, Marlon Vera was put in a pretzel in that matchup. Bill Cipher saying Pereira KOs him again. I don't see Adesanya winning if he keeps up his game plan of throwing 1,000 feints with nothing behind them and getting backed up to the fence. And one more, we'll go with stay dedicated love. Sorry, I think there's some people that you just can't beat, and Izzy has found that guy. So Matt, has he found that guy?
I think he has. And like, nothing about my MMA knowledge would suggest that Israel Adesanya should be able to win this fight. And I don't think he, like, Israel Adesanya is a 9.99999 like, 9 out of 10 in striking. The problem is, that is what he does. Like, I know he has some other parts to his game, but that is who he is. He is basically as good of a striker as he possibly can be. I say basically as good of a striker as he possibly can be because Alex Pereira exists. And I brought up my whole point at the start of this video for a reason. I think Pereira is really going to struggle against other guys in this division who Adesanya, with his grappling defense, might not struggle with. So I think we might see some odd MMA math as we go down kind of in history. Like, Robert Whittaker has a great chance to beat Pereira, I think, but Adesanya's already proven he has more than enough talent to beat a guy like Robert Whittaker. So for me, I think Pereira is going to be able to win this matchup, but I could see Adesanya getting the belt back. I don't think this is a case of him losing and we're not going to see him at the top of the division. I really do think it's just going to come down to who fights who for the belt.
Well, and I remember in the original video talking a lot about those two kickboxing fights because we had them and they hadn't fought yet. So those two kickboxing fights, in my words, in those, how was Adesanya fighting? He was fighting not to lose. He wasn't going out there and just staying on the outside, throwing a lot of pitter-patter, using a lot of movement, staying out of range of the power of Pereira. He was landing that big right hand like he did their matchup that they had in the cage. So if you do look at it for Israel Adesanya, you do consider all the wins that he had. UFC 281, that really big blip in the middleweight radar for Adesanya, hanging out on the back foot, hanging out behind that black line in the octagon, assuming that it's going to be another big cage at the Miami-Dade Arena. It doesn't play well for Adesanya, and he's found himself backed up in those positions in MMA fights before. Marvin Vettori,
exactly. He just can't make you pay the same way Pereira will because he's going to shoot for your hips. But that's a great point to bring up. Israel Adesanya finds himself in this position a lot, but the X factors that he has been able to carry over from kickboxing stifles a lot of MMA fighter strikers. Alex Pereira not only comes from kickboxing, but is one of the few men on planet Earth who has not only more experience than that. I shouldn't say more experience because Adesanya has a ton of fights, but has reached higher heights, I would say, than Adesanya did in that sport, and who has made the successful transition over.
Now, did it take for Pereira until the second minute mark of the fifth round to figure things out, or at least in the fifth round? He just started to pull away there. Yes, it did. And Adesanya, again, was up 3-1 on all three judges' scorecards. So for me, it's not often that I switch pick in a rematch like this, and maybe that's to my own detriment. History would suggest that usually the champ retains their belt in these circumstances, as it did with Edwards, and Edwards was in a similar position of Pereira being a big underdog against Usman when he was able to get that belt. For me, I will go with Alex Pereira because if he goes out there and sticks to that game plan, I haven't necessarily seen an issue with 5-round cardio in MMA for a guy like Pereira.
Pound for pound, he might be the hardest hitter in MMA.
Yeah, and if he can walk down Adesanya as he's able to do the last time out, I think he can find great success. So both of us in the matchup going with Poetan, Alex Pereira. Matt, I mean, on the last card, Vera versus Sandhagen, some people already touched on it. It was definitely a great card. Corey Sandhagen really cemented himself up near that top end of the division, was able to leapfrog from 5-3 to keep himself up there. Last weekend, you had, as I mentioned, Karate Combat, Gamebred Boxing, the PFL,
Fight Circus with Bob Sapp and Rampage Jackson. It was a weird weekend.
Doing workouts in the same shirt? They have a lot of press going
on. My wife and I were excited about it. It was behind a paywall. I was excited about Game Bread. It was $50 Canadian. You think I'm paying for that? So I didn't watch it. I just watched the highlights. But Matt, when it comes down to this card, you know we got you covered on that UFC action. And for this one, question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims here on the channel. There's been a wave of you subscribing, but not enough of you that are watching that are subscribing. So you gotta hit that subscribe button and toss us a like. It really does help us. It's free and it takes 2 seconds. We want to boost this channel up here in 2023, and it's coming at you with fights like this. We're really excited about it. Hopefully you like the intro and all of the video breakdowns. You're gonna want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it.